Good evening. I'd like to call the June 9th City of Columbia Planning and Zoning Commission. May I have a roll call, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stanton.
Here.
Mr. Strotman.
Here.
Ms. Rushing.
Here.
Mr. Chewy.
Here.
I'm here. Mr. Harder.
Here.
Mr. McMahon.
Here.
We have seven presents. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe. Any changes to agenda?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chairman. We are going to have an item that was tabled this evening, and since we have a full commission, if we can move that item up to the top of the agenda, and that is item number 16-101. It is a request to, I apologize, 16-118 is proposed to be tabled, and we'll just table that item before we start our public session.
Thank you, Mr. Zinner. approval of minutes. Everybody has a chance to review the minutes from our previous meeting. Are there any changes, corrections, updates needed? I see none. Can we have a roll call, please?
Yes. Mr. McMahon.
No changes.
What did you say, Mr. McMahon?
I have no changes.
No changes.
Mr. Stanton.
None.
Mr. Strotman.
I'm good.
Ms. Rushing.
No changes.
Mr. Toohey.
No changes.
I abstain, and Mr. Harder.
No changes.
We have six approving the minutes. The minutes pass.
Thank you. We'll move on to case 16-118, a request by Caleb Colbert, agent on behalf of Quonset on 10th LLC, to rezone land from M1 General Industrial District to C2 Central Business District. The 0.42-acre subject site is located on the northeast corner of 10th Street and Park Avenue and is addressed 300 North 10th Street. This applicant is requesting that this item be tabled to the July 7th meeting. May I have a staff report?
The applicant has requested a tabling to the July 7th meeting. This application was initially submitted as a rezoning request from M1 to C2. The applicant is working to look at alternative zoning classifications given the consideration that C2 will not exist under the adoption of the new MDT. So they are looking at some zoning options for this particular property, as well as they are investigating some other options that may deal with one of the principal reasons for the rezoning request, which was to alleviate the site from having to have parking on it. And there are some options that the applicant has that may be able to address the parking issue within the specified parking radius distance from the subject site. So staff is supportive of the request to table till the July 7th meeting, which should allow sufficient time.
Thank you. It is our practice to open this to the public. If there's any discussion that needs to be had from the public, we would allow it that at this time. And obviously, we wish you to come back to the July 7th meeting when we actually have the case in front of us. But if there's any input that you feel is necessary for us to know, I might ask for you to come forward.
I'm Dan Cullimore, 715 Lyon Street. I'm the president of the North Central Columbia Neighborhood Association. The owner of this property, John Ott, has been in conversation with our neighborhood association. We've been encouraging him to find alternatives to solve his concern for parking. We would not oppose tabling this at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else? As I see none, we'll close that portion of the meeting. Commissioners, any concerns, comments on this matter? Do we need a motion to?
Motion and a roll call, please.
Can I have a motion? Would anybody make a motion to table this item?
I move that we table item 16-118, a request by Caleb Colbert on behalf of Quonset on 10th LLC to rezone land from M1 General Industrial District to C2 Central Business District.
Thank you, Ms. Rushing. Does anyone like to second that?
I second.
Mr. Stanton? May I have a roll call, Ms. Lowe?
Yes. Mr. McMahon?
Yes.
Mr. Stanton?
Yes.
Mr. Strautman?
Yes.
Ms. Rushing?
Yes.
Mr. Toohey?
Yes.
I vote yes. Mr. Harder?
Yes.
We have 7 approving. Motion to table carries.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe. Moving on to case 16-110, a request by the City of Columbia to adopt a unified development ordinance governing subdivision and land use regulations throughout the City of Columbia's corporate limits as requested by the City Council and supported by the City's 2013 comprehensive plan entitled Columbia Imagined, the plan for how we live and grow. The UDO will replace Chapter 25, subdivisions, and Chapter 29, zoning, of the City Code, as well as incorporate provisions from Chapter 12A, land disturbance, Chapter 20 on planning, Chapter 23, signs, and Chapter 24, streets, sidewalks, and public places into its contents. This is the third in a series of public information and comment sessions on the proposed UDO. May I have a staff report, please?
Yes, you may, Mr. Chairman. Again this evening, Mr. Teddy and I are here to present in tag team fashion the contents of our next module, which is the Form and Development Standards, Part 1. This is basically Chapter 29-4 of the Code. As an overview for those that may be joining us for the first time for this process, we began our contract with Clarion & Associates and Farrell Madden, our form-based code sub-consultants, in January of 2014. The meetings prior to this have been held in a module format between January 2014 and November of 2015, when an integrated draft was prepared and placed out on our city's website for public viewing. Since the November meeting, staff has been working on its review of the document, receiving public comment until about January of 2016, and have now produced segments of the revised final draft of the UDO for the public's review during these information and comment sessions. These are not public hearings. There is no vote that is being taken this evening. There will be no vote until we have finalized and finished all review of the code and its contents, which is tentatively scheduled for the end of July of this year. We are in our third public information session. The next sessions that we have coming up will discuss our MDT zoning district, which is going to replace C2, and then we will get into additional design and dimensional standard requirements, which is the last half of Chapter 29-4 in our first meeting in July. So this particular chapter, because of its size, is broken actually into 3 different meetings, and we will be presenting you the first piece, which is manageable and generally related to each other tonight. The topics that we're going to cover are our dimensional standards as they are in a revised format. Again, part of the purpose behind the UDO was to ensure that we were streamlining and consolidating the code to make it easier for an end user to be able to access and review and understand the content that is within it versus what is currently in our code, which is more Euclidean and linear in nature, building upon each other district to district. And it repeats a lot of materials. So the new code is really a consolidation and a simplification of material that was repeated multiple times in our current code. And that really is evident with the dimensional standards as it was with our land use and our permitted use tables that we discussed at our last meeting. And we're going to also talk about density bonuses and when those do apply for development. We're going to talk about exceptions and encroachments, the things that you can do even though they don't comply with the regulations. We're going to talk about a revised subdivision standard process, the general provisions of what it takes to get a subdivision approved. There are a number of new standards that are within this particular section that are bringing the subdivision code more into a contemporary state of operation, consistent with other codes throughout the country. We're talking about our stormwater and our natural resource protection standards as well. The majority of this material is really a carry forward from Chapter 12A, land disturbance, which is in our current code. There are very few revisions, if any, made to this particular section based upon the sensitive nature of our stormwater permit that is a joint permit between the city, the county, and the university. And there's federal regulation and oversight on those stormwater standards. So there is very few, if any, standards changed. We have drawn them into the UDO to allow an individual wanting to know what it takes to develop within the city of Columbia and understanding in a single document to be able to see those standards. There are some tweaks that will be needing to be made to this particular segment of the code. Our law department has expressed some concern about how we are going to manage basically the leftovers of 12A that aren't being pulled into the UDO, and then how we relate them back and forth. So we're not quite through with the technical side of that, but really the content is not different. So that is something that the public does not necessarily need to be overly concerned about, that we are generating brand new standards. The one thing that I will tell you is different in 12A are our tree preservation requirements. Those are fair game since they are not federally managed like our stormwater and our land disturbance permitting processes. So there have been some changes, and those changes were noted within the document as a sidebar margin notes. Those changes are partially made by our city arborist during his review of the code, and then by the recently disbanded our tree task force, which has actually had an extension in its life to look at some additional tree preservation requirements for the city. We're going to talk about design standards that apply to development in general across the city, and then neighborhood protection. And Tim is going to cover the design standards and the neighborhood protection standards. These were two topics that were covered in the May 30th meeting that we had, the morning meeting, and there was a lot of interest and a lot of questions about these, and hopefully tonight's presentation will draw upon and answer some of the questions that were raised during that meeting that we had, which was really a preamble or a precursor to these meetings that we're having here before the commission. So, moving into our first area of discussion this evening, and that is our dimensional standards and what are they all about. Well, in essence, the dimensional standards that are in the code really are all of our setbacks, our bulk, and our area standards. And they have historically been in each individual zoning district within the code. So we would have had dimensional standards and bulk standards for our R1 single-family zoning district. We would have had a different table for our M1, our industrial zoning district, in each of the individual zoning categories or classifications that were in the code. Again, the principle behind the UDO is to try to consolidate and make simpler and put all of this information in one centralized location, not have it distributed everywhere. So the dimensional standards in the UDO are consolidated into tables that are organized by the land use groups that are the basis for how our permitted use tables are listed. So the dimensional standards for residential, for example, are all in one dimensional standard table. Single family, multifamily, two family, and the like are all there. We have unified setbacks for similar uses. So instead of having varying setbacks for a front yard, for example, generally the setbacks have been unified across the board. So from an administrative perspective, people aren't more prone to make errors, possibly, in administering what the front setback may need to be. We're not having to think about, oh, well, that's that zoning district or that use. It's going to have something different as a setback. We've unitized them in essence. The dimensional standards do propose some changes, and these are things that the public may have noticed as they have read through the document. The R2 duplex minimum lot area is one of those. Currently, it is a 10,000 square foot minimum lot area in today's code. It is proposed to be revised and reduced to a 7,000 square foot lot area. This is in reflection of some of the lots that we already have within the city that are in our R2 zoning district that are historically substandard in nature. This is also reflective of changes and recommendations made for allowing integration of higher densities in our more dense or our more inner city type areas where we have the R2 zoning classification already existing. This, in essence, is going to allow potentially currently underutilized properties to be utilized to a greater extent should they be redeveloped or if they're vacant today. The ADU standards that were created were one option to deal with that for a single-family home, and the ADU provisions do not allow you to put an ADU on a lot that already has a duplex. So what this is allowing, obviously, is now if you have a 7,000-square-foot lot, you can put a duplex on it instead of having to have that extra 3,000 square feet that you are required to do so today. The dimensional standards also include a new category that deals with attached single family and a lot area associated with it, and it is half of what a duplex would be. And the concept behind this is that the only difference between a duplex and a detached single family is really the ownership characteristic of what's the underlying land and fee simple title to that land. The form of the building really will not change any from a duplex. So in essence, we split the duplex lot size in half. You would be required as a builder to put in specially designed and code compliant walls between each of the units in order to have them, in essence, freestanding on their own individual lot. But the minimum lot area would be 3,500 square feet. There would be no internal setback between the two adjoining buildings, obviously, but all of the other setbacks for the underlying district, R2, for example, would be applied. So you'd still have a standard front, standard side, and a standard rear on the outs for the lot itself, just a smaller lot size. You would also be able to sell that attached unit as two individual units, unlike a duplex, which sits on an undivided lot and cannot be sold as two separate units. If you want to condominiumize a duplex, then you could potentially sell each of the individual units, but that's a totally different process. We have also created in the dimensional standards table a standard for cottage lots, and the cottage lot size is 3,000 square feet. It has a slightly different set of requirements as it relates to its front and its side and rear setbacks based on the size of the lot. So there are changes within the dimensional standards table that reflect that. We have added into the dimensional standards table as well mixed-use setbacks that are now based upon roadway frontage, the roadway frontage type, I should say, meaning that if you are on an arterial or a collector or some other characteristic street that we have defined within our code, the setback is going to vary, and it varies based upon the traffic volume that will be traveling along those different types of roads. As the road goes up in its intensity or its potential use for carrying more traffic, the setback generally gets larger. So if we have to ever expand the roadway, we're not buying buildings. We're basically being able to just acquire land. And then we have simplified the median setback definition. And that has been a discussion point in many of our meetings that we have had up to this point, especially those that we have had with our urban conservation overlay districts. The median setback currently is based upon the block. The proposed median setback calculation is based on the adjacent lots in the UDO. So it is taking the lots on either side of the lot to be developed, not along that entire block. It's created as a process of reducing the nature and the challenge of trying to determine the entire setback, the median setback of an entire block, normally requiring a surveyor to come out and have to do a lot of additional work. It was believed that this is a process that basically would achieve ensuring that the setbacks of a new building are respectful of the buildings that are immediately adjacent to it, which the new building is most likely affecting greatest. And then, of course, as if the block were to redevelop, you're going to end up then using the setbacks on either side of the future redeveloping properties. Ultimately, you'll end up getting something that may either be greater than what the minimum setback of that zoning district is, or will come closer to what the minimum setback of the zoning district is over time. This is the example table that I wanted to pull out for you. This is the residential table that I just gave great explanation about, and you will notice in a variety of different locations that we have the changes that I've indicated here in the R2 zoning district, just so we can dispel some fears possibly of the public. It is the only district that you can have that and RMF. They are the only districts that you can have an attached single family. An earlier version did include attached single family in the R1 zoning district. That has been so removed. There is also a use-specific standard that deals with the maximum number of attached single-family units that can be put together that applies in the R2 and the RMF district. The maximum number of attached single-family in the RMF, which is the replacement to R3, is 6. The maximum attached in the R2 zoning district is 4. You'll notice there is a red box around this 7,500 square feet, and if you look over to the left, you will notice that that says sorority or fraternity. We have historically never had a minimum lot area associated with fraternities or sororities. We are proposing within this code that the minimum lot area be 7,500 square feet. It is not based on the same density calculations that standard multifamily residential is based on. And it is because it is not a multifamily, while it has many of the appearances of a multifamily building, it is not the same by definition. So therefore, the lot area and the calculation for density on a fraternity or sorority lot is not the same. This is a lot size that is still potentially open for discussion. However, this is probably the smallest lot that you'll find in our historical Greek town area, which is just north of Kentucky and south of Burnham. So this particular lot area is really what it's going to take. Now, the lots, I will say, because of our other requirements for parking and some other things that are necessary in order to make redevelopment work, that lot area is probably infeasible to develop a contemporary fraternity or sorority house on today without significant modifications and Board of Adjustment actions. The 15,000 square feet that's listed below this is basically if no public sewer is available. It was originally within the cottage-style housing category. It was removed. We do not want cottage-style housing not on public sewer. It didn't seem to make much sense to city staff, so it was removed from here. You'll notice that, again, we've unitized setbacks generally in our residential zoning districts. The outlier is the RMH, which is our mobile home park district, and then again in the cottage district, which is basically a reflection of the smaller lot. Setbacks on the rear or front line as well, and we will get to this in a later section. We currently, on a detached garage scenario, the current code requires a minimum 60-foot setback from the property line. The new code in another section of our code that we'll get to as we move further is basically eliminating that 60-foot setback for a detached garage, but specifying that it sit no closer than what the front of the house can sit at in the future, which is 25 feet. Again, if you want to detach your garage and create a breezeway to connect the garage to your primary house, we don't want it forward of the principal structure, but we did not see any value in having a garage that's detached from the principal structure setback 60 feet. It just did not seem to make any sense as we evaluated the code. Rear yards really have not changed any. It's still the same calculation as we had previously. And then if we go back down into the actual height area of these tables, the height specifically with the residential is probably something that is of maybe greater concern. RMH, or the RMF zoning district, the replacement to R3, is 35 feet. It is consistent with what our current height maximum is in the R3 zoning district. The R4, which RMF is rolling into it, was 45 feet. So we basically have, on the R4 parcels that are out there today, which are very few, those will be legal nonconformities. Any new multifamily development will be a maximum of 35 feet. They are also subject to the neighborhood protection standards, which Mr. Teddy will get to a little bit later, as it relates to stepping down or setting a building further back from the property line when it's adjacent to a single family or a two-family dwelling. And then you may notice, and what seems odd, did at least to me, 75 feet is below this for a primary non-residential building. And it is subject also to neighborhood protection standards. And the best thing I can tell you is that 75 feet is based upon potentially a setback, an additional foot of every setback for height. However, if you build a detached garage within the exceptions component of our code, basically you can't have a detached garage more than 24 feet tall, which generally is, or taller than the principal structure on the property. So this is really not going to apply unless you're developing a multi-story building to where you have extra land by which you can set back an equivalent distance to be able to get the increased height. It is a carryover provision from what we have previously had in our code. So that could place the dimensional standards discussion. Wasn't it fun? Now we're going to talk about density bonuses. You know, I searched long and hard for graphics to make these entertaining, and this is not downtown Columbia, so don't worry. But we do have an opportunity for density bonuses within the code, and it applies in residential R1 and R2 zoning districts only, and they are corresponding to solar-oriented design and rural cluster housing design. And as I pointed out here in the slide, it applies only in these two zoning districts, so we're not looking at giving you a density bonus if you're in an RMF zone. And basically, you have the opportunity in either solar or rural design to have an increase of 10% in the number of lots that would be allowed. The way that that occurs is in a solar-oriented development, 75% of those lots have to be oriented within 15 degrees of true east-west, or is it north-south? East-west, in order to be able to capture as great as possible the solar energy from the actual sun. And then in a rural cluster development, which is something that we have talked about previously as cluster subdivisions, you have to preserve 50% of the gross land area in that development in order to be able to qualify for the rural cluster. And what does that mean then? So you have the opportunity to get 10% of additional lots. And how do you do that? Well, you get the 10% by reducing your lot area and width by 10%. So if you've got a standard 60-foot wide lot, for example, you can reduce that by 10% and have a 54-foot wide lot legally, and then you could reduce the 7,000 square feet by 10% as well. You cannot combine the two bonuses together. So you're going to have, if you want to have a rural solar bonus or a rural solar subdivision, you can, but you're only going to be able to increase your total number of lots by the 10%, and that's through the reduction in its size. This is an opportunity, obviously, to deal with some of the changes that are also occurring in our subdivision standards as it relates to more environmentally responsible development. So we've had to create a couple of incentives as to how do you make up for lots that you may lose based on some additional regulatory requirements that we are proposing to create through the UDO. You know, there is always an exception for every rule that we create, and that is why we talk about exceptions and encroachments within our code. So we basically have clarified some things within our exceptions and encroachments. We've also, through our regular design requirements, we have right-of-way dedication requirements are clarified. Currently, we have our CATSO plan, for example, which identifies future roadways. And the way that the UDO is structured, if that roadway is identified in our capital budget within the next 5 years for funding, that road right-of-way that would be required would be dedicated. It would be required to be dedicated as part of the subdivision planning process. And if it's not within the capital budget, one would assume, as it is written in the code right now, that additional road right-of-way would not be obtained. I will tell you that that may be a topic for commission's discussion based on the fact that right-of-way acquisition at the time of platting, when you may not replat a property for decades after it is developed, may or may not be appropriate if we are trying to secure rights-of-way for the future expansion of roadways. The concept, however, of why it is tied to the 5 years and in the capital budget is to reduce unnecessary acquisition of property, thereby impacting potential developments for possibly no value. We have also clarified the connection of accessory structures to a principal building. Currently, the code reads that it is by a lightly constructed material. This is currently proposed to be corrected by simply stating a breezeway, which is open on three sides, no greater than 6 feet wide, and has a roof line that is perpendicular to the principal structure, no greater than 12 feet, if I recall correctly. It was definitely to deal with the idea that you could take a 2x4 from your house, connect it to your deck, and consider that an attached structure. And that was really the rationale behind needing to change that standard. It was very flimsy, so to say. And we have strengthened it by basically saying it needs to be connected by a breezeway now, and breezeway is defined as well. So now let me go into my exceptions to every rule under my exceptions and encroachments. This particular section of the code deals with height and yard area exceptions. The majority of the requirements are very consistent with current Chapter 29. They have basically been pulled forward. We have not added a tremendous amount of new material, though the one highlight that has been added is driveway standards. We have now classified driveways for two-car and three-car garages and multifamily approaches, specifying the maximum driveway width that they can have and the maximum amount of coverage within the front yard. That is a significant advancement from what we have today, and that ties in again to another section that we will be covering in the July meeting as it relates to additional dimensional standards and landscaped area that's out in the front of a property. Subdivisions. We're moving along. So our new code, the new code does break subdivisions into two pieces, as I had indicated earlier. We talk about first what it takes to have a subdivision approved. How good does it need to be, and what are the pieces that go into it? In Chapter 5 of the code, we'll talk about the administrative process about how a plat is approved and what steps it must go through and the different types of platting actions that we have as a city. But Chapter 4 really deals with, 29.4, deals with the idea that subdivisions are going to be taking a turn, and they're going to start to look at things that were addressed within first the East Area Plan and looking at sensitive land analysis and trying to avoid those areas, and then further articulated as part of the environmental goals and objectives of Columbia Imagined. And right out of the gate, the subdivision standard section starts with avoidance of sensitive areas and the requirement that any new platting action over 5 acres in area is required to provide a land analysis map. And that land analysis map needs to identify all of our sensitive features that may lie within the boundaries of that tract of land. And the development pattern within that particular tract needs to avoid those areas. And avoiding the sensitive areas that are within that tract of land may permit a 15% reduction in your lot size and width. Now, this is another one of those options because you're taking the time to analyze your property, or I shouldn't say you're taking the time because you're required to now, and you in essence are avoiding the sensitive features such as karst topography, something that we recently came across on the Breckenridge project. Or you are avoiding a stream buffer area that you could otherwise potentially have included in a lot and basically have that as part of somebody's private backyard. There are some limitations. There are particular set-asides that are somewhat sacrosanct that you cannot do anything with anyways, like floodways. So those types of things do not generally – those are unavoidable. And in essence, this particular avoidance of sensitive areas and the actual opportunity to increase the lot area requires that a developer or his engineer produce a before and an after snapshot layout, in essence, of the actual development tract of land. What could occur realistically if he was not avoiding any of those sensitive areas? And then basically what is being proposed, and that is where your 15% reduction or your 15% opportunity comes into play. You will never get, the way that the code reads, you can reduce your lots by the 15% in size and width. You will never yield more than the total number of lots, however, than you would have gotten if you didn't pay any attention to the sensitive areas. So what this is allowing is somewhat of an idea of a cluster subdivision or something to where you're actually pushing your development impact area into the areas of least sensitivity through smaller lot sizes and smaller widths, but you're not basically going to be getting really any more a significant amount more density out of the property. You're just getting better usability of your property, because otherwise we could potentially tell you, no, we don't want you developing in karst land areas as a regulatory standard, and that land comes off of the table automatically. This basically takes into account that you've got gross acreage and you've got gross volume on your property, and you can move it around and protect what you need to protect. We have streets are also addressed within the subdivision standards as they are today. The classes are the same as are in Chapter 25. We still have residential streets, arterials, collectors, and the like. We have created some newer, more improved standards for streets within low-density R1 development areas, allowing for the avoidance of piped stormwater systems, a curb and gutter, and a variety of other standards that would typically apply to any other type of residential street in a regular residential development. This basically applies to lots that are over 2 acres in size. There's a sidewalk variance that's built directly in, or I should say exception, that you're not required to build sidewalks along these rural-type residential streets. We did clarify within this particular section as well that any street that runs through that rural development that is identified either as a collector or an arterial does not get the sidewalk exemption and would have to do the regular stormwater improvements that would be otherwise required in a more urban environment. That's obviously to protect the public as they may be walking along those peripheral streets to the development itself. But once inside that low-density development, again, there was no value seen in potentially having that additional impervious area created by having sidewalks, curbs, and the like. One thing I would like to jump back, and the 15% reduction under our avoidance of sensitive areas, some folks may have read in the initial version that was produced in October, that was 25%. It was reduced by 10% to ensure that we were not going to end up with lots that were less than 50 feet wide or less than 7,000 square feet. So the 10% reduction, or the taking 10% out of it, actually is it would have, if we had left it in at 25%, we would have ended up with substandard lots in general, smaller than what we have today, and we felt as a staff that that was inappropriate. Wanted to make sure that the minimum lot size was still 50 feet and a little bit over 5,000 square feet when we're done. Coming back then down here into connectivity. Connectivity is a new, I wouldn't say new, but it is a revised and I guess a refined version of what we have in our current code. We currently talk about subdivisions needing to basically be having their road system built out to adjacent undeveloped property, stubbed in essence as we refer to it, so you have the ability to connect adjacent subdivisions together. That's not changing at all within the new UDO. However, we are introducing some new standards for through-street connectivity from a graphics perspective. So basically, if you are surrounded by roadways around the perimeter of your property, you are going to need to have connections to those exterior roadways at particular intervals in order to allow for north-south or east-west connectivity through the larger tract of land. This model is somewhat based off of how our CATSO plan is arrived at today, where we talk about having major roadways roughly every half mile. And part of this is basically driving that concept behind our CATSO plan to help fulfill or facilitate better connectivity through larger tracts of land. As an alternative to meeting that diagram or that, we have a connectivity index that is also being proposed within the UDO, which takes into account intersections to street segments and allows opportunities for you to reduce or to modify how your development may have to connect to the exterior street network that surrounds it as alternatives instead of having to follow the letter of those diagrams. Staff has identified that the diagrams are wonderful. However, trying to only rely on a diagram may not be the best way of trying to convey the concept, so we are going to probably be looking at backing that that diagram up with text, so those that are maybe not as graphically inclined can read the text and understand what we're trying to get at. Again, moving on into subdivisions, we talk about street length as well, and this is somewhat of a different animal than what we have done in the past. We are reducing block lengths. Currently, they are 1,000 feet. We are reducing them through the UDO to 800 as a maximum. So straight street segments, which normally define your blocks, are 800. Cul-de-sacs are generally capped out at 300 feet unless you have extenuating circumstances associated with terrain, but in no instance is a cul-de-sac supposed to be any longer than 750 feet, which is consistent with today's standard. The general provision of a maximum of 300 is new. And then we clarify when temporary cul-de-sacs are required. If we have a street segment that dead ends, either as a stub or just dead ends because it's ending at a lot, if it is less than 150 feet in length, it does not require a temporary cul-de-sac. However, anything over 150 feet does. This also ties back to the International Fire Code and our fire services needs to have a turnaround at the end of those particular locations, even though, as I have been told in other employment, fire engines have reverse. So that is a standard that is new. It is also half of what is the current standard in today's code. Lot access, another major area that is being revised, and this is, again, tied to the International Fire Code and the appendices. No more than 30 lots or units may be located on a single-access residential street. There are exceptions built into the code in working with the fire service on this. We are aware that multifamily actually has a slightly different version. They allow more units off of a single point of access, as well as the fire official or chief has the ability to grant modifications to that on a case-by-case situation based upon what is there. The current provisions that a secondary access is not acknowledged until it actually becomes a secondary access is retained in the code, which means that if you stub a street to an adjacent undeveloped property, that stub does not count as your second access until the adjacent property is developed and that street is continued. So that is brought forward, and that philosophy will be carried as we move on with new development under the UDO. Sidewalks, another wonderful area that we seem to always get wrapped around the axle about here. We have tried, desperately tried, to simplify the sidewalk standards within the UDO. We have clarified when they're required to the best that we can, and it happens in two ways. You're either going to have to build a sidewalk after the UDO is adopted. And this includes provisions for plats that were approved after January of 2001 already. So any plat under today's Chapter 25 standards approved after January 01, you have to have sidewalks in them, period. The real challenging side of what we have been struggling with for several years is what happens to those subdivisions that existed prior to 2001. We had conflicting section within the code that said every subdivision was supposed to have a sidewalk in it. And as the commission is very familiar with and the public often that comes and maybe listens, we have a lot of requests for single lot subdivisions that are the last lot in the development, you know, and they're trying to subdivide and they don't have a sidewalk. So what ends up happening? You come and get a sidewalk variance and we all scratch our head and say, well, this doesn't make any practical sense. We don't have a sidewalk plan. There's no sidewalk in the area. So what we have attempted to do in the code is basically indicate that plats that were approved prior to January of 01 that are less than 25% complete are required to build sidewalks. And for some odd reason, that doesn't make sense. I think it was supposed to be the other way, that maybe have been 75% complete. I got to read that. Now I'm confusing myself. But nonetheless, we have tried to simplify this to where it's now going to be based upon the total number of lots in a development that are not built out. If the development is nearly fully complete and we're replatting a property, you're not going to basically put a sidewalk in because that neighborhood's complete, or you're building a house on an existing lot. Currently, the code requires that when you build a home on a lot in an existing subdivision and it doesn't have a sidewalk in front of it, you're supposed to build a sidewalk. So if that subdivision plat is pretty well built out, that provision wouldn't apply. If you replat, and I apologize, if you replat property, you're going to be replatting, and it's going to be after the UDO is adopted and after January of 2001. You're probably still going to see sidewalk variances. But again, the sidewalk variance process is trying to be simplified a little bit. We acknowledge that this is not the greatest section. It is still somewhat a work in progress. We all have scratched our heads up on the fifth floor. We've said we really need to get a sidewalk master plan that's more articulated, and we need to identify where we want sidewalks to connect with a network. And that is part of what the evolution of the code process is and the plan process. And that is something that we have suggested that we need to do in the side margin of the code. We need to comprehensively look at the sidewalk network within the city and where do we want to allocate those resources to build sidewalks. This is better than what we have, as much as it sounds like I botched what I just explained to you. It is a little bit easier. It resolves at least one problem, and that's what do we do with properties that were platted prior to 2001. And then basically we will still have to continue to work on how we deal with sidewalk variances for those properties that are platted after or replatted after the code's adopted or after January of 2001 or don't fall into the exception of being in a completed subdivision. Sidewalks are also going to be under the new UDO required on all arterial and collector streets. Currently, within the October version of the integrated draft, there was a provision that basically accepted out a grouping of particular types of structures. As staff went back through and evaluated this particular section of the code, we felt that it was not appropriate to be exempting out residential development, for example, single-family residential development, that would be along a collector or an arterial from having to build a sidewalk. Arterial and collectors are heavy carriers of vehicular traffic, and we need to ensure that regardless of the type of building that's occurring along those roadways, sidewalks are built so we don't end up with sidewalk gaps. Often what we will find, if it is a residential lot, it's going to be a residential lot that backs to that collector or arterial. We do not allow lots under our current code generally direct access to collectors or arterials anyways. So in the development scenarios where you may have a lot that has a double frontage, the back lot, if they were building the house for the first time, that back lot line that may be along that collector or arterial may not be required to put the sidewalk in. But you may have sidewalk on either side of it, and we create a sidewalk gap that may exist for however long. So we're trying to close that gap by requiring through this version of the UDO that sidewalks be required on all collectors and arterial regardless of the type of development. We have also clarified common lot sidewalk construction requirements. Currently the code reads, or Chapter 24 reads, that sidewalks along common lots are to be constructed at the same time that the roadways are to be constructed. So that's generally within the three-year performance contract. So that's really not a big change. However, what happens when you don't have a common lot along a public street frontage and there is no development, but you've got sidewalk network that's already in the actual community? Basically, what we're saying here is common sidewalks need to be built within 3 years. And if they're not built, we're not going to accept basically the streets for maintenance until the sidewalks are constructed. We need to be able to ensure that the sidewalk networks in particular subdivisions are completed because they provide a pedestrian service. This may be an area that we say that do they need to be constructed with concrete like everywhere else, or do we need to do something that's more of a temporary sidewalk construction to basically shoulder the burden or the need to have to make that investment up front of concrete sidewalks to only be torn out when housing construction may occur on adjacent vacant lots. The idea, again, here is to try to make sure that the sidewalk network is completed to provide that service for however long it takes in order to be able to get those lots in that development developed. You have probably driven through countless subdivisions in Columbia after the market downturn and saw, you know, segments of sidewalk here, segments of sidewalk there, and nothing was connected in some instances. Market's changing, and we're getting a better opportunity to fill in those voids now. Again, subdivisions, continuing to move front on lot frontage, another major component that we have within the actual code that is different. Currently, lot frontage does not basically require that you actually have to have a lot fronting to something that you can have direct access to. The code makes very clear now that lots have to be created having actual lot frontage, so they have direct vehicular access to them. A waiver is possible, and it is based upon a series of circumstances, either development pattern or some other type of topography or something else that basically does not allow you to do that, to provide the direct frontage to the street. And that would be through an irrevocable ingress-egress easement that's approved by our law department, which we will likely have a form developed for that somebody would need to fill out. It would also likely require the commission to approve that as part of the platting process. You'll notice that the diagram references a series of different types of lots. Each of these types of lots is referenced within our lot area. We talk about flag lots, which are referenced in our code as a tier lot, interior through lots, and corner lots, and the like. All those lots are types of things that we see in subdivision plats today. We've had an up-and-coming problem as it relates to common lots that house stormwater facilities, and the need for those common lots to have roadway frontage like any other lot. And we have discussed with our stormwater staff, and we have identified in a couple of more current platting actions to where those common lots that have stormwater features on them, we don't want a stormwater feature sitting in the middle of somebody's backyard because of maintenance reasons and other liabilities associated with that. If the city were needing to get in there to maintain that, it's easier to have it on a separate freestanding lot. Therefore, you plat it on a common lot. But that common lot still has to have some type of access to it. The preferred method would be to have street frontage so you can get to it. However, in some instances, the development of a subdivision with a stormwater BMP is in the back of the development at the bottom of a slope, and that's nowhere near a road. So how do you deal with that? We propose within the code that a common lot for stormwater not have a frontage requirement, but it does need to be accessible, again, by an irrevocable ingress-egress easement that is traversable. So if maintenance is needed, it can be obtained. We can get access to that and do that maintenance as potentially required. Common lots in general, those that are either used for active or passive recreation, are another type of common lot. Those would typically also have a minimum of 20 feet of roadway frontage. And under the code today, it specifically states that it has to have roadway frontage. So often what you end up with is you end up with that flag lot type configuration for a common lot that may be tucked back behind a bunch of homes that's either a greenway or a park space. What we're suggesting is instead of platting that common lot flag, basically, that could be in an easement format that maybe traverses a public drainage easement that's a piped public drainage easement that leads back to the main stormwater retention facility. It creates an option by which to create common lots that would otherwise be considered isolated or landlocked, but still provide access to the general public or the neighborhood to get to that lot without having to basically take street frontage in order to do it. You may be able to use a feature that you already have to plat within the subdivision. And then we basically also address within the frontage requirements of the code the minimum frontage standards for mixed use or special district lots, special districts being our ag, our IG, which is the industrial, and our open space district, and then the mixed use districts being MN, MC, MOF, which is the office district, MBP, which is the business park district, and then our planned development districts, all having to have a minimum lot frontage of at least 30 feet, no stems or protrusions less than that. And that is very consistent with how we currently have our code set up today. Stormwater and natural resources. As I had indicated in my opening remarks, this particular section of the code really pulls forward most of the requirements for Chapters 12A into the UDO without alteration. It is really a repeat. There have been some tweaks that have been made in order to reduce intent statements or findings, legal findings statements, for example, into purposes or intent statements. That's one of the changes that has occurred. Existing 12A is going to remain in its modified status at this point. So there are going to be pieces of 12A that we are not pulling into the UDO that are going to remain in 12A. And that is one of those areas, as I said, that we are still trying to resolve with the law department as to how do we want to do that. Does 12A stay whole, and do we repeat what we're pulling in the UDO so you have it in two different locations? That's not ideal, because if we do make revisions, you've got to make sure that you make revisions in both locations. So it is a procedural issue that we have to deal with at this point, and we have to walk softly in that area based on the fact that there is so much other interrelated regulatory involvement by the city, the county, university, as well as the federal standards that we have to comply with. The application requirements are noticeably not in the UDO. They will be in an administrative manual. So application standards for all of our stormwater land disturbance requirements, all of that will be in a separate administrative document, which will be where most of our administrative procedures are for what it takes to apply for subdivision, a zoning action, and the like. They will be in a administrative manual outside of the code, so if changes are necessary, they are not necessarily required to go back through the ordinance amendment process every time a new innovation in administration comes along, or we need to change the number of plans we need to receive, or something along those lines. It could be a more fluid and amendable document. The definition of logging is possibly needing to be revised. There were comments that had been received, and there was actually an observation on the staff side that logging means the removal of three or more trees off of any individual lot. Well, if you're building a home, you're probably going to remove more than three trees. So we need to clarify within the document logging in its intent. We're talking more or intending more to be talking about commercial logging operations or land clearing operations as we refer to the broader term of logging. I would tend to agree with the comments that have been made that it does seem to be a little bit narrowly defined at this point, and that's an area that we will continue to look at, and there will be a discussion point that we will have with the commission as we move forward. Tree preservation is, as I had mentioned earlier as well, this is the one area of Chapter 12A that is open for amendment because it is not necessarily tied to our federal requirements. This is something that was adopted by the City of Columbia independently. Currently, the code requires a minimum of 25% of the climax forest on any parcel of land greater than 1 acre to be retained. And that does not change any. However, what does change is how that 25% is maintained on one site that is greater than an acre. Currently, the 25% can be distributed across the site in very small chunks of land that really serve no forestry management purpose. And the code proposes to require that the 25% of climax forest that is identified on a site prior to the logging operation occurring or any type of clearing, we do have a tree protection and tree identification plan required within the code. That 25% needs to be in one contiguous stand of trees that is platted on its own individual lot and protected under a conservation easement. The concept here is under the current code, if you subdivide your property up into R1 lots that are less than an acre, each individual homeowner could decimate that 25%, and therefore we're trying to ensure that the climax forest has a fighting chance to survive on that property over time. The arborist can provide a much greater explanation of this if necessary, but that's the layman's approach. I just prune trees. I don't actually preserve them often. And we have no tree credit, no credit for trees that are within your stream buffer. And this is another major change. It was originally proposed in the October version of a 20% credit toward meeting your 25% climax forest. Stream buffers are one of these areas that are actually, as I indicated earlier, more of a sacrosanct type area where you're not supposed to be in it to begin with. And therefore, to let you, in our minds, double dip to count trees that are in an area that's not even for development purposes didn't seem to be appropriate. Trees, however, that are in a stream buffer do count towards the buffering requirements of landscaping and screening. We will allow you to use them as a screening device, but we will not allow you to use them to meet the requirements of the 25% of the climax. Most climax forest is going to be along these waterways to begin with, and therefore once you get outside of that stream buffer, the area that's on the higher ground, maybe that's not nearest the channel, is what we're going to see as preserved and keep that intact forested area. Interestingly enough, this ties back to a green infrastructure planning objective of Columbia Imagine. It was in the environmental section of the code. It may also promote for, obviously, better water quality management along our creeks and streams as the community continues to grow, providing a greater amount of land area for filtration purposes so we are not degrading these streams at a faster rate than may otherwise be occurring. The stream buffer requirements, which is another component, we have land disturbance, grading, stream buffers, and tree preservation. The stream buffer requirements are consistent with Chapter 12A. There have been virtually no changes made to this particular area. All of the stream types, the buffer widths, all of that is carried forward from 12A, as is noted within the footnotes of the current draft. Stream buffer requirements do apply to any redevelopment or development within the MDT, so that is something that that was what was originally contemplated, and that is how it applies today. And then we have also added clarification on who makes design standard modifications to stream buffer requirements. That is actually the purview of the Public Works Director. It was not necessarily stated that way in the original October draft. And I'm going to hand this over to Tim so I can take a drink.
That's taken on a disproportionate amount of tonight's summary. What I'm going to describe are two additional sections, and these are all of 5 pages or parts of 5 pages out of the code. 29-4.8 is called Design Standards and Guidelines. And 29-4.9 is called Neighborhood Protection Standards. First, the design guidelines. This is something that has general application, although, as you can see from the bullet, they're not applicable to one or two family dwellings. These standards also don't apply in the MDT, which is the form-based downtown district. Reason is there's a number of design-oriented standards in that form-based district. There's also selected uses besides single and two-family that are specified in the code that are generally not very intense in terms of their structures. Those are also exempt from this, but otherwise has general application. Purpose is to allow full development of properties consistent with the dimensional standards established in this code while establishing baseline requirements for building and site features that will create stable residential neighborhoods, mixed-use, commercial, and industrial areas. A number of other purposes are specified, enhancing the public realm, reducing conflicts between existing and new uses, encouraging effective development of street frontages, encouraging creative and sustainable design, and improving the overall design quality of the city through the use of objective standards that can be administered by Community Development Department without the need for individualized design review of projects. In other words, there's an effort here to be simple and really rely on just a few objective principles and not let a lot of subjective judgments enter into the administration of these standards. But here's what they consist of. First of all, a requirement that in development, one or more functional doors face and are visible to the street. That may seem like something common sense to say, and I would expect that if we had no such requirement, we'd find nearly full compliance with this. But there may be occasions where you have, for example, a rear parking lot to an establishment, and the impulse of that particular developer is to provide their main entry off that parking area and not leave an entrance facing the street. You also have sometimes entries that are turned perpendicular to the road, and actually this is something that's fairly common in grocery stores where they have an entry vestibule and the doors are actually perpendicular to the street. and something the commission and the public may want to think about, would that be something that would qualify as a street-facing and visible from the street entrance? I think clearly in the former example, where there's no door at all, this standard is intended to apply. There are building facade articulation and foundation plantings required around the entry. There is a 20% transparency requirement, meaning 20% of walls facing a street are required to be transparent materials when the use occupying the first floor level is food and beverage, office use, personal services, or retail use. And to clarify, the way the code is worded, even if you had a three-story building, if the ground level is occupied by one or more of those uses, that 20% is that 20% minimum is going to apply to the entire street-facing facade. So just want commissioners to be aware of that, that that's the way the standard reads. There is a place here. There is a wall plane articulation requirement, and we are, if adopted, we would not allow a section of building to be as long as 100 feet without some kind of wall plane projection. By that meaning one section of wall would have to be either closer to the street or recessed back from the street. This graphic, by the way, just is illustrative. The 50-foot that's in there and the 5-foot dimensions, those are not regulatory. That's just illustrate the point in there. So the code doesn't say how much offset is required. It just says there has to be an offset at least at an interval of 100 feet. There are roof shape requirements where if a building has a sloping roof, there'll be a break in the horizontal line of that roof. Again, using 100 feet as the standard, we're trying to avoid monotony in a fairly large building, such as a commercial building or a multifamily structure. And then if it has a flat roof, the same principle applies. No flatness may go on for 100 feet uninterrupted. The code would use the parapet, which is the section of wall that protrudes above the flat roof, and require some variation in the height of the parapet. And here there is a dimension specified. There'd have to be at least a 3-foot difference in that parapet. Canopies and awnings are addressed. That's just saying a clearance of 7 feet is required. And then loading dock and delivery areas are going to have to be located at the rear of buildings. And this is to separate customer and employee traffic from loading and service vehicles. There is an allowable exception that can be made if the director determines that that location would be impracticable given the function and operating needs of the building. Here I'll offer one example. You might have a situation where the rear lot line of a commercial establishment abuts residential, but the side abuts commercial, so it, other things being equal, it might be better to actually put those loading areas to the side. And here again, I'm thinking of a grocery store example in town where that is exactly how the building was designed. So there is opportunity for exceptions there. That is it for the design guidelines section. As I mentioned, it's quite brief. Neighborhood protection standards follows. And the intent of this section is to preserve the residential neighborhood character of established homes within multifamily districts and adjacent to mixed-use or special zoning districts. These standards do apply to all lots in the RMF district, which is the multifamily residential district, other than when a single or two-family dwelling is being built. So any multifamily building that's built in the RMF would have to follow these neighborhood protection standards. It also applies to lots in any zone district other than an R1 and R2 that would share a side or rear lot line with a lot in an R1 or R2 district. So in other words,
they function as a transition between zoning districts. Here are the requirements. Building height, there is a choice of two ways to satisfy this requirement. First of all, a building that would qualify would have to be stepped down in height within 25 feet of the side or rear lot lines, and that step down would be to a maximum of 24 feet of height, and that's just within 25 feet of the side or rear lot line. And here I'll quickly add that if it's a multifamily building that is being designed, normally there's going to be a rear yard, so it's probably a non-issue on the rear lot line because there'll be no building that's within 25 feet. However, if there's a variance situation, this would apply, and then it would often apply against a side lot line. And there's been a change. The draft that was published in October of last year and has been online for some months had this standard as a 30-foot, a step down to 30 feet in height within 100 feet of the lot line. The staff has done some review of this standard, and it's their feeling that it would be a bit impractical to run that step down as far back as 100 feet. However, a more dramatic step down to something that is of a two-story, commonly two stories, would be more appropriate nearest the side and rear lot lines. There is a second option for compliance, and that would be to increase the side and rear setbacks a minimum of 10 feet beyond that otherwise required in the zone district where the property is located. So an individual designing a three-story structure, for example, that's adjacent to residential, single-family residential, would have the option of maintaining that height, but they'd have to add 10 feet to the side and rear minimum setback, so typically 20 feet on the side of the building in that example. Screening and buffering, there's a clarification here. There's a more extensive screening and buffering section elsewhere in the ordinance, but this just clarifies that where a opaque fence is required, landscaping is to be installed on the outside of the fence, meaning it's facing the single or two-family dwelling that the lot is screening from. So that is in there as well. And then there's a requirement that we don't have now, and that's that parking areas, driveways, or circulation aisles cannot be placed in between the principal building and a lot line of a use that is a single or two family. So to use this photo as an example, we have a single family lot here. One could not run a driveway to a parking area for this multifamily building along this lot line, even if it had enough space to accommodate it. There'd be traffic to and from that parking lot that would be somewhat obtrusive to the single-family use. And here again, there is an exception that can be allowed in cases where this requirement makes this requirement is impractical. Director can approve a parking lot design that locates either the parking area, the drive-through lane, or the circulation aisle in between the structures, but there would have to be a 6-foot landscape buffer that would be introduced as an alternative. But that would be the obligation of the applicant to show that they really have no other way to comply with that. Final standard in this neighborhood protection section is maximum height of any lighting pole within 50 feet of the side and rear lot lines shall be 20 feet. We allowed normally light poles of 25 feet and then an additional 3 feet with a the use of a pedestal for a light. That's the normal maximum lighting height standard. This is a way of stepping down the lighting a bit in that transition zone. And that would apply, for example, in an RMF district, that would apply for any multifamily building would have to comply with that standard. It's not determined by what is on the other side of the lot line. That's the way that draft code reads. So that concludes my presentation on those two sections.
So where are we going from here? As we talked about today in work session, we have three more meetings that are tentatively scheduled. There may be more added based upon the discussion of the MDT at our June 23rd meeting. And then possibly discussion of the third component of the dimensional standards, the design requirements on July 7th. We may end up having to move our meeting dates back, but these are the three scheduled tentative meetings that we have: June 23, MDT, July 7, Part 3 of Chapter 4, and July 21 will be our enforcement and procedures section. The Planning Commission's public hearing is tentatively scheduled for August 18th, and that is a very soft tentative date, and then council introduction would be tentatively scheduled for September 19, again, likely a soft date at this point given the discussion that we are having as it relates to public comment. And as I just said, this is exactly what we will be covering at each of the upcoming sessions: parking and loading on July 7th, landscaping and screening, exterior lighting, which is not changing any, and sign standards, which is not changing any from the current code requirements, enforcement and procedures July 21st, and that will wrap up the code itself on July 21st if we stated the schedule. Enforcement and procedures basically deals with all of the processes. The procedural section deals with all of the processes to get rezoning, subdivision approval, going through the Board of Adjustment, amendments to the MDT, and the like. And then the enforcement provisions are just what enforcement is. It's how we enforce our code for those that violate. You can reach the draft, if you are interested, from the city's website, como.gov, and just look on to the planning and development page of community development and look underneath the development code update project link. We have added the chapters that we have covered here this evening, or the sections, out onto the website, and we will continue to add additional information as we move forward. There is one thing I would like to point out as a point of clarification if folks are interested. The minutes for each of these meetings are captured in verbatim, and therefore if you want to go back and you want to read the minutes, you are more than welcome to do so. Minutes for the preceding meeting always show up on the agenda under the approval of the minutes for the meeting that follows. So tonight's meeting minutes will actually be presented on the June 23rd agenda, but you are more than welcome to get those, and they are available 4 days in advance, as well as tonight will be the first night that we will be we are live streaming our video, as council does, so you will be able to access the video of this evening's meeting anytime from your PC after tonight, probably Monday morning, and you will be able to replay this section of the meeting if you so desire to hear anything that we have said in our staff presentation, which is actually not captured within the verbatim minutes, but all public comment will be. And that public comment is being reviewed by staff after the conclusion of each meeting, and we are working with the commission at this point to identify and categorize all of the comments that are made so the commission has an opportunity to review them prior to completing the final draft of the document for a final vote. So with that, I will turn the meeting over to you, Mr. Chairman, for public comment.
Thank you, Mr. Teddy, Mr. Zinner. Commissioners, are there any questions for staff?
Yeah, actually, I had a question.
Mr. Teddy, go ahead.
With the subdivisions and the cul-de-sacs, so the 300 feet, is that the minimum, and then 750 is the maximum? Is that how that will work?
I would suggest that there's no minimum. You know, a cul-de-sac is a cul-de-sac. Typically, the general provision would be 300 feet as your maximum length on something that is not constricted or not impacted by topography or other reasons. So you will, as an applicant in the subdivision plan, have to identify why you need something that is greater than 300 feet but less than the 750. So a variance requirement would be required for anything greater than 750. I think what we would end up doing, and again, this is something that is new to us as well as a staff, anything that's over 300 feet, we would probably identify to the commission at the time of the staff reporting that this cul-de-sac does not meet the standard 300-foot maximum for the following reasons. And that cul-de-sac, however, is less than 750. Anything over 750, it's a variance or a modification request that you would have to act on and council would have to approve. But in between those two numbers of 300 and 750, at this point, I, from an administrator perspective, would not see the need for a modification request. Applicant would, however, have to justify to staff that that length is necessary. Otherwise, you need to put in some type of loop street system or some other type of road or street that would accommodate meeting the requirements.
I've got one more question. The situations that give the director authority to make decisions, is there an appeal process for those decisions?
Yeah, it's Board of Appeals. Okay. Board of Adjustment hears appeals, among other things, from decisions a director might make.
And that, Mr. Toohey, is only applicable to the zoning requirements of the code. Subdivision code requirements are actually appealed directly to council.
Any other commissioners? I've got a couple questions, if not. Just looking for a little clarification. The 20% transparency with when you have retail or office or food on the first level. So obviously on the first level, you could have more than 20%, but every level above that would be required to have 20%, correct? Is that?
Well, it's 20% in the aggregate, and then half has to be at a location where it's not more than 4 feet off grade. In other words, a decent amount of windows at the street level or sidewalk level.
But it's aggregate for however many you have.
Right. Okay. Right. And I just wanted to point out the way that language is written, I would interpret it as meaning the whole facade, even though there's a reference to use on the first floor level.
Right, but you get to use the multiple, however many floors above it. Okay. The loading and delivery areas that are located at the rear of a building, help me understand how we would handle one of our current or our automobile, the guys that are running the car dealerships. Predominantly, they do a lot, if not all, of their unloading on the city streets in a lot of cases. Would this apply in that case too, or is that?
I think that's something we'll want to look at when we do the parking standards, because that's where you get into what type of facilities have to have a loading area. This design guideline is taken for granted that there's a design process in which they are actually placing loading docks or roll-up doors in a building and directing then employees and contractors to those service entrances. So it's really saying when you have them, you got to have them in the rear. I think you're raising a question of at what point do we require the car dealer or whatever other user customarily unloads in the street. If the decision is that that creates some kind of nuisance impact, it might be something we want to look at as a requirement, where you actually make a facility where that car carrier has to go. If it's something we think we can live with because it's relatively infrequent, then we let it go. But that would be my response there. I'm trying to recall if certainly service bays and things might be a different category when you're dealing with something automotive. I think it's understood that the service bays are going to be located somewhere in the front of the facility. They might be side-facing but or inward-facing, but they're going to be to the front.
Okay. And then my last question is currently or going forward, the maximum light pole height would be 25 feet on any type of zoning?
The ordinary lighting light pole height requirement is 25 feet, and that's the same as the 2006 amendment that we made to the zoning ordinance. There's an additional 3 feet that's allowed for pedestals that the poles stand on. So we like to say 28 feet is the tallest for the
So really the 20 foot would just be for that the outer perimeter poles to step it down.
That's correct. And over the years, having seen a number of plan districts that are commercial in nature that involve site lighting, there was always a natural movement toward or a natural negotiation towards bringing those light pole heights down. So this kind of codifies that.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioners, any other questions? But with not, I'll open up to the public. We would ask that anybody would like to come up and ask for clarification or ask a question to staff or to commissioners. You would do that. Just please give us your name and address, and we would welcome you guys to start coming on up.
My name's John Clark. I live at 403 North 9th Street. I'm an attorney and an accountant in Columbia, Missouri. So starting up, I was listening to the neighborhood protection stuff. And so I was particularly struck by the, you know, no parking or driveways next to. What I'm particularly interested in this stepping down stuff is not having the ability in that zone between whatever this new big building is that's impinging on a neighborhood thing, not having the ability to drop a parking lot in there, not having the ability to drop mechanical equipment, put all this kind of stuff in the back of your building and this kind of stuff. Now, I must admit, I could be wrong. Maybe we're only talking about streets, and across the street are some houses, and then the building, all the facing is this. But I'm really worried about this, and particularly back in the mid-2000s, when I was leading North Central, I led a negotiation with Kilgore's. And one of the things we put up, and actually still on your agenda, is basically corridor planning. What I'd like to see in this is to make sure that it says, if you're going to build buildings, in addition to the step down and so forth, there's a requirement that they be designed as four-sided buildings to be neighborhood friendly on all four sides. And actually, this is one of the things we negotiated with Kilgore's. And so they basically didn't just have brick on the front and two sides, they had brick on the back. They made special arrangements about their mechanical equipment, about the dumpsters and this kind of stuff. So that general concept, not only stepping down height and other kind of things, I think you were referring just now to the issue about the height of the poles being the perimeter. I'd like to see in this somehow or something that prevents that space between, especially in some of these things where it might be being, in essence, being used for junk and by some kind of standards. I think maybe this notion about designing from four walls, this kind of stuff would work out. But somehow or another, working that into this. The second thing was, I must admit, I was, for the first time, I brought this little PC thing that I had. Half the time that you were talking, there were slides up here, and whoever was guiding this thing was filming you talking. I would suggest, especially since this is going to be streamed and re-seen, you might look at that. Because, of course, I'm trying to write and so forth, but especially people who are at home, what they would really like to see, and I noticed back here on these cameras, you could see the slides up here, but they had shifted, or the visions up here. I would like you to have the slides about what you're talking about up there, and maybe 5% of the vision time be on YouTube. It's not that you're not good looking, and it's not that you were smiling, but I think 95% of that for the purpose of all this.
That's a good point.
And I think this is probably just standard notion about what you film, and it's no harm or foul, but you might direct them to that. I'm going to take it when you're talking about specifically, and I like the idea of the sidewalk master plan. There's some really big issues, and they're not specifically in this project, about who the hell is going to pay for these things. And by that, I mean right now, I like the idea of the sidewalk master plan, but I'm not interested in lots of things being totally paid for by the general public, and certainly in the center of the city by HUD money. So if you'd make a footnote, and I think we're working on this, and I think Councilman Thomas is working on this in particular, about how money gets put aside to pay for the sidewalks on Ontario collectors. When we have a really good road development charge, maybe we should have a sidewalk development charge to go along with that. The last thing I had, I attended the work session before. Were the handouts that you had, are they going to be up? You know, we're talking about the spreadsheets and so forth. I know they weren't out in advance, but if I look tomorrow, I'll see those.
Which handouts, John? The ones from
whatever you were talking about, including the various comments.
Oh.
But everything, basically everything you passed out to the commissioners tonight.
We can post those. That won't be a problem.
I'm going to campaign for some other things, but I wasn't going to ask you for them then. But I like that idea of the running spreadsheet, and I'd like to be able to see those. And I think everybody else would like to be able to see, if you hadn't heard about this, all the public comments are going to be a spreadsheet with various developmental stages about how you're reviewing them, linking them, referring to what they refer to. Those are my four comments for tonight. Thank you very much.
Any questions for the speaker? Thank you, Mr. Clark.
I was that clear.
Crystal.
Dan Cullimore, 715 Lyon Street. Just a few questions, I suppose, mostly. Is there anything in the UDC that allows for the development of tiny houses? We have a significant interest in affordable housing in Columbia, and tiny houses are typically under 800 square feet. They don't necessarily require a 3,000 square foot property lot to be built upon. And if we're not looking at this as a potential development or redevelopment model, we probably ought to, and we probably ought to codify it as well. Perhaps that would be included in the cottage district details. I haven't had a chance to look at those. Something else. You mentioned a rural cluster design. I'm curious if there's not something that might be termed urban cluster design that would be applicable perhaps within a cottage or a tiny house district. Recently, there have been a number of R2 and R3 redevelopments that appear not to have had to address stormwater mitigation. I'm thinking of developments on Ash and Garth in particular. These are multiple duplex units that have been built on land which was cleared a number of years ago. They've been essentially functioning as green space. And apparently the redevelopment is almost entirely hardscaped, either with roof or paving. And if that is not addressed in the new code, it needs to be, because we've added a significant burden to the stormwater issues that we face with that kind of thing. Regarding the Climax tree and forest areas, I'm pleased to see that the code recognizes that these need to be contiguous areas. 25%, I think, is a good starting point. I would recommend that there be something developed to attempt to lump as many of those 25% areas together so that they are contiguous across lots as well, because that's really how you get a climax forest area. You don't have 25% here and 25% here, but they're clustered together, they're more likely to be significant habitat. I would like to second what Mr. Clark mentioned about foresighted development, foresighted design. And a question whether or not it's enough to have wall and roof articulation on only the street side of large multifamily developments in particular. There is a unit on being developed right now on Rogers, which is prompting my questions about this. It's very well articulated on the street side, on the Rogers side. On the back side, however, this 19-plus unit development is completely flat. I think it's in two planes, and the roof is entirely one plane. So, and finally, I realize that staff is doing a significant amount of work already, has done, and will continue to do. But if some of the dimensional standards and design standards that if local exemplars could be identified for instance, the 25-foot setback and 25-foot height, if there are local exemplars of that, it would be good to have some reference to those so that we could actually go out and see what this thing looks like in situ.
Any questions for the speaker? Thank you, sir.
Good evening. My name is Tom Trebue, the residence at 3530 Old Ridge Road. I want to talk about two issues, and ask a question about one. The first is the Climax Forest, and I am a little bit concerned about having that one contiguous tract of Climax Forest. I do understand that it's important that the Climax Forest that is preserved is of significant size, that it can be managed as a forest, but on a large tract, sometimes that does need to be spread out around the tract. And so I just wanted to voice my concern about that and give some consideration so that we don't codify that it has to be one contiguous strip. The second item, Mr. Chairman, you talked about the loading docks, and I just wanted to voice a little bit of a concern with that. I would like for us to consider the loading docks to be possibly on the sides of buildings as well. And my biggest concern there is for a loading dock type application, the amount of turning radiuses that are required for trucks and that type of thing will require an awful lot of real estate, but additionally an awful lot of impervious surface. And I know we're trying to eliminate impervious surface. And so I think oftentimes a loading dock on the side of a building that might be parallel to the side of the building allows us to get those trucks off of the street. Certainly understand that's a problem in some of our areas, but it allows those trucks to get off the street but not take up as much real estate and as much paving. I'd ask for consideration of that. And then the last is a question, and it's on the screening and buffering, section 2949E, parking, loading, and circulation. And this is just a clarification for me, whether this applies to lots that abut a zoned residential district or lots that abut a lot that has residential uses.
Be whether it's just a second. I'm just going to read from it. This is on the Neighborhood Protection Standard for parking, loading, and circulation.
That's correct.
You're referring to.
That's correct.
Yeah, it's those facilities cannot be located between a principal structure. This would be the intense use, and a lot in any side property line abutting a lot containing a single or two-family dwelling. So the single or two-family dwelling is there. It's
right,
not,
and so that's about a use. What if that particular residential use was on a commercially zoned piece of property? Not that we have a lot of that.
You mean single family on a
single family on a commercially zoned property?
No,
and we'll have some of that on the fringes.
If it's used as single family, it's not a single family structure. It's been converted to commercial. The principle is that you would be buffering it as a residence, so it would apply. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because it says it doesn't refer to zoning districts. It says no parking area, drive-through lane, or vehicle circulation driveway shall be located between a principal structure on a lot containing a use other than a single or two-family use, meaning the intense use, and any side property line abutting a lot containing a single or two-family dwelling. So it's any side property line abutting a lot containing, it doesn't say how that single or two-family use is zoned.
Right, and I wanted to clarify that. I'm a little concerned about, and we are on in this buffering area and this step-down area, and I understand the concept there, but we could actually have some commercially zoned property that for protection purposes, somebody might go in there and build a residential structure, which would be allowed, and I think that would really upset the intent of what we're trying to do with this unified code in revisions. And I don't know that there's going to be a lot of that, but that's one of those areas that I've noted as a as an area that's a little bit of a concern. Thank you.
Any questions for the speaker? Thank you, Mr. Tribu.
Good evening. My name is Mark Farnan, 103 East Brandon, Columbia, Missouri. I have three things. First, I had sent several documents to you guys earlier. Thank you for taking a look at those in your earlier work session meeting. They were designed to help move the process forward and to add clarity to the consideration of all the different questions that come up. Looks like the staff has a way to keep track of that and tend to identify the issues that come up here at each of these individual hearings. I still fear that we're going to get to a big cluster at the end where that last meeting is going to be several hours long when we debate the finer points, or that some things that may seem like little things are going to get left behind somewhere. And to some people, little things are little things, and to some people, they're going to make a whole lot of difference. And I want to make sure that those are captured and discussed where people really feel good about it. The second thing is also a process thing, and this is really sticky and probably everybody hoping I didn't bring it up. This past Monday, they established a new parking and transportation task force, and they created that with a six-month limit, and that's how long those people get to do their work. That's right. Then they'll have their report, their final report on parking and transportation ready to go on December the 6th. That their primary focus is supposed to be to make recommendations about the Unified Development Ordinance as it relates to parking, particularly in the downtown area, and about other modes of transportation that might be appropriate and be addressed in this unified code. That is well beyond the time limit, and the list that we showed here that shows that our last meeting like this will be in July, take a month, and then in August maybe we'll take a look at this great big Christmas package. How are we going to incorporate the work of the parking task force into this code if they're not going to have their stuff done till December? In fact, that was created last Monday, and at that meeting it was indicated that probably they're not even going to be able to appoint and have the first meeting of that task force for a month. And at the first meeting, then you say, nice to meet you all, here's your duty, go do it. And that takes a month. Except in this case, there are two very, very different opinions about how parking should be addressed. And some really want more and some really want less. So this will not be a slam dunk decision. So add a month. And my sense is that they're not even going to have a preliminary report ready for 3 months. I think that there are a lot of people who think that we're pushing this pretty fast, that it needs more baking time, I've heard that reference, and that what we could do then, instead of you all having to have those extra sessions built in that were mentioned earlier, and that you might do them every week, let's stretch this out a little bit. Let's go ahead and do, well, first of all, I don't think we can ignore what they're going to do. They were appointed for a reason. And their prime reason is to make recommendations about this code. If we just ignore that or act like that's not there, we're wrong. Or we could lengthen the time and use that time, or we could do everything we can get done now and do that part and send that forward, and then once they get their stuff done, then we could come back and reopen the hearings and we could do that part, except for one thing. This is the Unified Development Code, not the Bits and Pieces Development Code. We have been in this position before, and we have done legislation piecemeal, and that sometimes is really ugly. And so I don't think we should do that. I think that we should intentionally do this well, and if it takes longer, that's okay. And I don't even know what the outcome of that parking task force is going to be, and I may not even agree with it when we see it. But we've got to do this right, and we have the opportunity to, and I think that is an important thing for you all to talk about, and I'd sure like to know where you stand on that, because I have to plan the rest of my summer. The last thing I want to talk about is to address the mentions in the subdivision part that was talked about here tonight as it relates to the relationship of that to the comprehensive plan. This is the part where people have to submit a land analysis map. And in there, it says that some parts of it is just fine, and it tells you exactly what you have to do. You have to look at a USGS map, and it will say, here's a dotted blue line or a solid blue line, and this is what you need to show on your map. Or this report from the government about soils, and you have to show that. Or this report about endangered species that's available as a government report, and that has been verified. But then it says, or F, any area that is not covered in this code or not articulated, that's not articulated, then we're going to go to the city's comprehensive plan, and if they have identified something, then we could include, but not limited to, cultural and or historical features, burial mounds, wildlife habitat, wildlife corridor. How, when I put together, if I did, a land analysis map, how do I know what I do have to put in there if the guidance says these are the things that you have to put in there that are not listed? Or how do I define things that the comprehensive plan did not define itself and make sense of it, or how do I determine which contradictory statement that is in that comprehensive plan rules today? For instance, there is reference made in this to the wildlife habitat, wildlife corridor, and it says whatever the comprehensive plan. There is no map in there that shows wildlife corridors for the city of Columbia. There is not one. Deer run through my yard from Sally's yard to across my street to my neighbor's yard, jump in that little creek that bisects his yard and run down to the trail. Am I a wildlife corridor? And how do I draw that? What do I reference? It's not a USGS map. It's not any of that that has been issued, and it's not in the comprehensive plan, but it seems because the comprehensive plan mentioned it, it gives that jurisdiction somehow. I have had to have rabies shots in my family two times because bats fly and stay at my house. We are in the flyover zone for bats. And it extends from McBain and goes up through the grasslands and out through Benton Stevens and out of the city. Is that a wildlife corridor? And how is that shown on the map? Who gets to define that? And why should it be the comprehensive plan? There are a lot of references throughout this plan to the comprehensive plan, and I understand why that was made. And in fact, in the comprehensive plan, which I read again last night, every line, it says that that plan is a guide. It is not the law. That's the way it was sold to us when we made it. It's the way that at this meeting people have referred to it time and time and time again. It is simply a guide, and what I think this does is takes a step too far in trying to codify something that is a guideline into a regulation. And weirdly, the Columbia Imagine Plan agrees with me. Because these are vague, because these are not well-defined, because they're not defined at all or non-existent in that, then I think that they are just kind of innocuous. I don't know. But here's what the plan, that comprehensive plan that we may want to refer to as a guideline, says about things like this. It says we should reduce ambiguities in the subdivision and zoning codes by refining the language to be more specific in its intent and implementation, and to encourage preservation of usable, accessible open space. And then, dang it, it says in planned unit developments, and it takes us right back to where we were trying to get away from. This is not the document that was created years ago that we should use. We can use it as a guideline, but it should not be the basis for the legal requirements of a new thing that's being introduced in this zoning code. I have one other thing that was bugging me about this, too. There's the little quote I just read, but here's the map that is in the comprehensive plan, and this is the future land use that is referred to, the future land use map. And it's a little bit hard to see, but if you look at where it says that you can't do anything and you have to list on your deal anything that's in a sensitive area, you're going to get your deal knocked out if you're trying to do a subdivision. But look at what this is. All that area that I'm kind of running the cursor around on is this hatch mark place that is defined as, and so is all that green out there on the south east corner, all that comes in there, that's all called sensitive area. It is also, what that includes is also the place that the same plan says is an employment district and is zoned commercial at Discovery Ridge. Who wins that fight? Is it considered to be in a sensitive area or is it not? And is that map accurate or is it not? And is it just indicative and should be used as a guide? Or should we just delete that sentence from this code, rely on the specific language, as is indicated here, that it appears in the rest of the code, and we all get it? This is a reasonable request. I wish that it were different, and am asking you to make it so. That's all I got tonight. I'm sure I will be back. Thank you. Oh, and if you have questions, I'll go.
Are there any questions for the speaker? I see. Mr. Farnham, we do appreciate your help with helping us try to categorize the citizens' input, and we do appreciate all the work that you've done helping us with that.
I appreciate your time as well very much, all of you.
Janet Hammond. I live at 1844 Cliff Drive. Everybody keeps saying how many things they have. Two things. So the first is I've been asked several times about a draft copy of the code to be at the library. And so
that's in production. Yeah, we didn't get it done for tonight, but shortly we'll have copies over there.
Thank you. And the other comment I'd like to make is about the median front yard setback. many of us who live in the Central City neighborhoods feel that protecting our neighborhood character is of utmost importance. And we have relied on this median front yard setback that has been in effect of the entire block to help us protect our streetscape. So this current proposed change that would only apply to a dwelling on either side of a new development or redevelopment would cause creep on the entire block. It would not protect a block from visual differences of the neighborhood. And so many of us feel, well, you know, our neighborhoods don't have homeowners associations, which many new neighborhoods have. We can't set restrictions. So we have to rely on something that's traditionally been used. So we would ask that, you know, this continue in this way to use the entire block on the same side of the street as the way to determine the setback of a new development or a redevelopment. And having the cost, whether staff does the measurements of houses or dwellings or whether a surveyor does, is actually a pretty small price to pay to preserve neighborhood character. So,
are there any questions for the speaker? Thank you, Ms. Hammond.
Thank you.
Good evening, Caleb Colbert, attorney at 601 East Broadway. First, I want to echo what Mr. Farnan said about some of the land analysis map, some of his comments. I do want to follow up on those a little bit. Just a couple of quick questions. On page 211 of the document that was published for this evening's meeting, the last sentence says, and the way I read it, is that in the land analysis map, you have to show two types of sensitive areas. Those sensitive areas shown on the map that Mr. Farnan displayed, and then all as well as all other areas known to be sensitive. I'm not real sure what is included in other areas known to be sensitive if it's not shown in the map that Mark put up on the screen.
I would suggest, Caleb, that is probably where one has to go to the listed criteria of specifications. When we generated the future land use map that is part of the comprehensive plan, we did not look through the endangered species gotcha. List that's part of that. So hence the reason why we cover certain things and other documents that exist that have been produced by others are also referenced.
So that is just intended to be a reference to the more specific items that follow in the next subpart.
And that would I would tell you yes as the administrator of that, and I would say that we probably could foreshadow maybe more so in the preceding paragraph that's there in I, that's what the expectation is. Hence, I think to Mark's point, F is the catch-all statement that's really listed with I and that last sentence that says show everything on the comprehensive plan, future land use map, plus everything else.
Gotcha. Okay.
I want to add a comment that reference to the comprehensive plan in the land analysis map section to me is alternative language to a common phrase that's used in codes, which is other information as may be required by the commission. Codes I've worked with in my career, when listing supportive data, will list those things that often are requested, but there's that catch-all statement just because you don't know all of the things that the commission is going to consider relevant or the public is going to consider relevant. And this is offering a little bit of wiggle room, if you will, for us to request on behalf of the commission some additional data based on our professional judgment about a site. We had a case recently has an Indian burial mound on it. So that's not on our site analysis list, but that might be something that we want to see additional documentation on.
But as a property owner, where would I go to find out whether or not there is like wildlife habitat on my property? Because anything can be wildlife habitat.
That's part of what we're here for. We do try to guide applicants through the process. We do a pre-application stage of review where we advise on what kinds of documentation is needed to have a meaningful review process. So.
Sure, but just as a, on behalf of property owners, when they're coming forward, they want to have a degree of predictability and certainty as to, what they can do with their property. And when there are sort of these vague, nebulous terms, it creates a lot of uncertainty. When you have uncertainty, you have unpredictability. Unpredictability adds to more cost to development. So I think it would be helpful to have, more specific, either eliminate the catch-all provision or give us some more, rigid guidelines that we can follow.
We can try to make it as specific as we can, but I don't know that we'll succeed in having the once and for all exhaustive one size fits all list. But we'll certainly try to make it as clear as possible what it is that's required to have a complete application, because I think that's the concern, is that a property owner might get in a loop of having their application continuously rejected. Because the land use analysis is not an exhibit for you to approve. It's a supportive exhibit. It's not part of what's going to get approved. But in the sense that it might be deemed incomplete, you want language that you can advise a client, for example, if they follow this, you'll proceed in the process.
Right. Well, and we talk about subdivision plats as being, ministerial, not discretionary. Well, the more ambiguous language that we have, does that lend itself to making the subdivision action more discretionary as opposed to ministerial?
I would also suggest, Mr. Colbert, that part of what we're doing here with this land analysis map is it's a requirement of concept review. So preliminary plats, plan development, annexation requests, stuff that requires a concept review within our procedural standards are going to allow us the opportunity to identify what may or may not have been collected at the time of producing that request for the concept review before an applicant gets into a design exercise of greater cost. So that is another major deviation, or I would say, from what we currently would require with a concept review today. This is somewhat detailed. You have to take the time as an applicant to consider the impacts that your proposal is going to create on that land, and we are recommending that the land use analysis through the code be provided at the time of concept review, not at the time of submission, because at the time of submission, you've already designed a project, and by that point, then you get into an even greater level of uncertainty. And I would agree with you that from a ministerial action at some point no longer becomes ministerial, because we are going around and around. So we're trying to create a process by which we get the biggest bang for the buck on the front end. So when the project comes in, you can take advantage of the density bonuses that may exist, because we've already identified those lands as part of the development plan design. I'm not going to tell you that our staff, nor from an administration perspective, we may identify every single feature on that property through the analysis map that may exist. But we're making a huge stride forward from what we currently have, which is basically almost ignorance to any type of preservation techniques or analysis of those features that should be preserved, which is a goal and an objective of the comprehensive plan. It's to preserve the environment that we have. We only have one. And as we develop, we continue to eliminate those land areas.
As far as the preservation easement itself, will that allow any development? That's not a defined term in the...
That is correct, and that is something that we identified as we were going through the process, that preservation easement does need to be defined. It is not going to function like a conservation easement, a green space, open green space conservation or trail easement. That's not the intent. The code does, as you've probably observed, if you can't avoid a sensitive area, and it has to be included as part of a lot. The code does acknowledge that that's going to likely happen at some point. The building envelope of what would be built on that lot needs to be defined to be outside of it, however. Now, I would imagine, and again, it's not, we have not looked through fully all of those implications as to what's give and take. Where do you, like we allow for stream buffer averaging in our current Chapter 12A, is there an opportunity to allow for sensitive land averaging of some nature? There are probably options that exist that we just have not thought through far enough to be able to get there. And I think, again, that's part of, I think, what Mr. Farnan's comments have been. We've got some of these issues that may seem very small, but they may have a very large impact at the tail end, and that's hence the value of, I think, these sessions. This is allowing us to think about these things.
Sure, and to follow up on his map, the sensitive area overlay, I mean, that doesn't mean that every square inch of that property is a sensitive area.
No, right. and not at all.
Right. I just wanted to clarify. As far as the switching topics on you, as far as the cul-de-sac length, am I correct in understanding that the default is 300 feet?
That is correct.
Okay. On the tree clearing, there's a provision on page 268 which says that landowners in the county who annex into the city have to comply with the tree clearing requirements, so they have to wait 5 years to develop. Is there a look-back period? Explain to me how that would work.
Well, this is a provision that comes out of the temporary abeyance provisions that are currently in the county's regulations that have not been enacted since the city has not adopted parallel requirements. So, yes, there would be a look-back period. Again, it is a technical process. We have the capability through aerial photography that's sufficient enough for us to be able to identify properties that have been cleared. There are a plethora of exemptions that are legal within the county as agricultural uses that can allow property to be cleared. And the hesitation I have had since I have been here over the last 3.5 years or four that this item has shown on our agenda to adopt a temporary abeyance ordinance has been fully surrounding that particular topic. That there are a series of legal options for somebody to clear their land prior to annexation that we cannot control in the county. And that, I think, creates some challenge with this particular provision. And I think that is something that still has to be developed. We have to review that, I think, collectively as a commission and a staff and truly determine, is this truly enforceable? Is it reasonable? Is there a different way of dealing with it, such as a mitigation standard that needs to be developed? If you have legally cleared your property and you are annexing into the city, you may have to provide some type of enhanced tree planting back. To not ban you from getting a permit. I mean, those are the types of things that I think have to be evaluated before we basically jump all the way to say that you're penalized because you cleared your property legally in the county, but you wanted to annex.
And they may have happened 4 years ago. I mean, the 5 years seems like a pretty harsh penalty, and it can be a trap for the unwary if your property changes hands in 5 years.
I would tend to agree. The tree task force working with our arborist, I believe, has taken an approach that some of the tree protection standards that they would like to see implemented are made legitimate and may have some penalties associated with them. Again, in work session with the commission on this particular topic, we have talked about the idea that if you know the regulation, regardless of what side of the city boundary you're on, be it in the county or be in the city, you're put on notice. And I think the problem is we don't have a regulation that anybody can know about today, and to jump immediately into a penalty phase without first being able to create some way of relief may not be the best way to achieve the end goal, and that's forested tracts of land.
That's all I have for this evening.
Any questions for the speaker? Thank you, Mr. Colbert. Yes, Mr. Clark, if it's short.
John Clark again. I still live at 403 North 9th Street. I happened to hear John Engen, the mayor of Missoula talk about, and maybe some of you did, about their big rezoning update and a whole bunch of things they did in Missoula. And one of the particular things that they said was crucial to the implementation of their zoning as defining quality development was some work that was done that created exactly the map that is being talked about. We've talked about it. It was, and you can go to their website, I think, and find it. It was called a carrying capacity kind of map. What it really did were both Missoula and the county in which it sits, it did this massive analysis of features, carrying capacity, all this kind of stuff. It provided a trusted base of facts for anybody who was applying to develop, the city staff to use. I would encourage you as part of this process to get a hold of that, look at, follow up with a staff person who had, I think, since left Missoula. I think it is the very document and tool. Now, we might have had that if we'd gone on with our area plans for the whole city. But that might be useful for us to figure out how to do in a time frame that would make it ready for the point at which we're ready to eventually adopt the UDO. And it might address what I think are the very pointed and good questions about where are we supposed to look. In Missoula, apparently, they solved it by developing this very detailed kind of map that really laid down the groundwork for anybody who was making application to do these things to use. I would encourage you to follow up with that.
Mr. Clark, did you have a name for that map? Was there?
I will go back.
That's fine. I didn't know if you knew it.
John Engen was here, and you may have been at the Affordable Housing Symposium. You can hear the description of how valuable this was if you just listen to that two-hour section, which he and his cohort, I think Ray Winkleman, were talking about. But in that and in the question and answer session, they make detailed reference to this and how it got done in general and how important it was to them in going forward with they feel their zoning stuff to find quality development. That's why they didn't have the student housing problem there that we've had. But one of the key, there were multiple components to that. They're also an impact fee state. But in addition to that, they update their zoning codes and they make reference to this map. And I think it is the very kind of thing that is being talked here about what is needed. And I'll see what I can find as well.
Thank you, sir. Yes, Ms. Hammond.
Columbia has helped fund the Natural Legacy Plan for Columbia Moot County. Are you aware of this? It's in conjunction with the Parks Department and the Greenbelt Land Trust of Mid-Missouri. And so you might look and find that and talk to Mike Griggs, the Parks Department, and there's an implementation phase that is being worked on at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Hammond. Are there any speakers from the public that would like to have some time? As I see none, I will close the public hearing. And that portion is done. We've got three agenda items in the subdivision. Is commission ready to continue moving forward? Sounds good. Our first subdivision, case 16-101. A request by Engineering Surveys and Services on behalf of the City of Columbia for approval of a two-lot final minor plat to be known as 6th and Cherry Garage Subdivision, along with an associated variance in section 2546B. The 1.6-acre subject site is located on the northwest corner of 6th Street and Locust Street. This was an item that was tabled from the May 19th meeting. May I have a staff report, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. As you stated, this is a final minor plat request. The request of subdivision would create two legal lots on this one block here, as you can see, bounded by 5th, 6th, and Cherry and Locust, currently owned by the City of Columbia. Part of the request is is a variance to the city's subdivision regulations 2546B, which is requires truncations at corners of intersections to incorporate a 30-foot radius on that intersection corner. So, and I'll show you a little bit of example of that here in 1 second. Here's kind of an aerial view of the site. As you can see, it's the city's Cherry 6th and Cherry parking garage structure on the east portion of the property, and a surface parking lot on the west side of the property. Generally, the variance request is for the west side of this property. The east side, as you can see here, basically this portion that's within the shaded red area, is representative of what a corner truncation would be. Basically, it is a curved radius along there to facilitate basically traffic movements and also in the downtown to also provide enough pedestrian facilities for sidewalks and other types of infrastructure. So the variance is only applicable to the northwest and the southwest corner of this lot. Based on the variance request, staff did look at the site. Again, part of the reason for the truncation is, and really the applicability of that requirement applies a little bit more in general to more traditional suburban development where you do have traffic flow and you're looking for turning radiuses for cars to be able to turn without slowing down or without making basically facilitates traffic movement a little bit better. There's less of a need for that in the downtown where traffic movements are more actually desirable to be a little bit slower. So the other thing we looked at in this location for the variance would be then the need for additional sidewalk space. So the applicant did provide an exhibit that showed basically where the property line is versus where the edge of the area that could incorporate a sidewalk. And after reviewing the additional information from the applicant, staff did determine that there would be enough space within the right-of-way to incorporate enough sidewalk for a suitable downtown sidewalk width to actually meet the minimum standard, not the minimum standard, but the minimum or the prescribed width of sidewalk downtown, which is 10 feet, which is actually above what the required width is. So they're confident that in the future, if the sidewalk did get built, there would be enough there for the 10-foot sidewalk without granting the truncation on the west side. But to get to that point where staff would support the variance, there's a couple conditions that we would be asking to basically preserve or to ensure that the sidewalks can be built with little impact to the city. And another one to ensure that there's no misunderstanding with the existence right now of some infrastructure within the right-of-way. So I'll go over those real quick. So staff is basically recommending a couple conditions. One of those is the requirement that the property owner grant to the city in the future temporary construction easements at no costs. This scenario really only comes up if the city would come in and construct the sidewalks prior to the redevelopment of the site. So the west portion of this property currently is a surface parking lot. So if they did come in and actually redevelop the site and construct a structure on the site, a building, they'd be required to build these sidewalks, and so the city wouldn't be involved in that. In the scenario where the city would actually come in and reconstruct some of the sidewalks, as you can see downtown, they do have plans for some sidewalks, reconstructions and intersection reconstructions downtown. So in the scenario where they look to put in additional sidewalk, they may need to actually have equipment or to be on the property, and that would facilitate the need for a temporary construction easement. With the granting of the variance for not granting or for not dedicating the additional corner truncation, we felt it was appropriate that they grant to us the ability to construct that sidewalk in a manner that may require the temporary construction easements without the city having to pay for them in the future. The other condition would be, as you can see here on the very southern portion of the property, The blue area here, the shade, represents actually a portion of the surface parking lot that extends into the right-of-way. Now, right-of-use permit basically is a form that property owners need to have approved by the city if there is infrastructure that is not the city's located within the right-of-way. So this is kind of a standard thing, but in this situation, because of the situation with the city potentially transferring the ownership of this in the future, we wanted to make sure it was clear that any future property owner that wasn't the city, because we don't necessarily need to grant ourselves the ability or the approval to have structures in the right-of-way, we wanted to make sure it was clear to any future property owner that this portion of the surface parking lot was in the right-of-way, and that at any point in the future, the city needs to remove that portion in order to install the sidewalk up to that 10 feet width, that was at the city's discretion. So with some notification requirements. So again, it's a not necessarily uncommon thing, but it is something that we felt was important just to make sure everyone's aware of what that situation is with the service parking lot on the south, which is required to make sure we do have the necessary pedestrian facilities there. With that, I would say that staff is recommending approval of the variance for the corner truncation waiver on the northwest and southwest corner. And with that, also approval of the final plat of the Six and Cherry Garage subdivision. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Do we have any questions for staff? Yes, Ms. Lowe.
If the 30-foot radius is being waived, what minimum radius is being established?
There'd be no radius on the northwest and southwest corner.
Has the radius ever been waived for a downtown block?
Yes, we do have examples of other ones in the downtown being waived with variances in the situation. Many times those are waived with situations where the building's actually in place. The building's built up to the corner property line, and so therefore granting a truncation would actually place the building in the right-of-way. I think in those situations we looked at that as a very practical hardship for dedicating that additional right-of-way, given the fact that the city is unlikely to come back and demolish the building to be able to actually use that corner truncation. So,
has there been any case where it's been waived prior to construction?
I don't know if I know the details of every case. I do know there was a one plat that was approved. Well, that would be a different situation, but I know the block where Stevens College is located, they did not have, I think, any type of new construction per se on that, and they granted the corner truncations, but not a situation where a building hadn't been constructed, or in that situation where it was waived. So not that I know of, but this situation doesn't come up very often downtown, given kind of the nature of most of the lots downtown are currently platted in some configuration, but as new development occurs, this does come up occasionally.
If the commission approves or recommends the corner truncation, is there a standard that identifies a minimum radius for the curb?
No, and that's actually a conversation we've been...
Because I couldn't find it anywhere. Yeah.
Oh, if it's waived? No, if it's waived, then there would not be a truncation on the lot.
It's not identified anywhere else in the code.
No, so that's something internally we've had conversation with, and I think with the UDO it may be something that's addressed well as the necessity for a 30-foot truncation, which is, like I said, a little more akin to more of a suburban-type corner radius. So it's something we could look... We've discussed basically reducing that, some other options. I can't tell you if that's what the recommendation will be in the future, but
now I know I live in the city, but I know I can't make a 90-degree turn in my car even if I am driving pretty slowly.
Right. So it sounds
and
like
my purview of the city corners was none of them are at 90 degrees. So it seems a little short-sighted not to have some minimum radius identified if
Well, I think there's a couple different things going on. It's the lot isn't truncated, but a lot of times the curb line is truncated.
Right, and that's what I was trying to clarify.
Yeah, so the city's traffic standards would still have, you don't see curb intersections at 90 degrees downtown. They are truncated. So I think the issue there is if you have And one of the reasons we're looking at other truncation type requirements is, you know, if you have a 90 degree building, but then you have to truncate the curb, you do lose a little bit of space there because you're not taking advantage of the entire space because the building kind of extends in that area.
Right. So if you can tell me what the curb would be radiused at, that would give me an idea of how much the pedestrian.
I couldn't tell you what the exact
path
truncation
would be reduced to when we got to the corner.
I couldn't tell you exactly. I do know that our traffic department did review it and said that they felt confident that they'd have adequate sidewalk width.
I appreciate that, but so. I would like numbers.
Sure, we can get you that information.
Thank you.
Standard curb radius, Ms. Lowe, is generally, it ranges, if I am correct, depending on traffic speed, anywhere in between a 30-foot radius down to, I believe, 15.
I agree.
And that is, in many instances, what you're seeing in the field, obviously, while you're not making a 90-degree turn, is because we haven't built from property line to property line with the road. Standard road section basically has about 12.5 to 14.5 feet beyond the actual back of the curb to the property line, hence where the green strip is and where the 5-foot or larger sidewalk's located. So in this particular instance, in this site specifically, if you look at where the actual bulb outs are located on the northwest corner and then on the southwest corner, that affords the radius that to allow for the sidewalk as well as reduces the pedestrian crossing distance between the opposing sides of the street. We will have another request that will be coming to you in a upcoming Planning Commission meeting for the Alpine Shops on Hitt and Broadway, which will also have a request for a waiver of a corner truncation. Again, there is a planter sitting out toward the intersection of Broadway and Hitt that you have to pull beyond the existing property boundary of the Alpine Shop in order to make the right-hand turn to get out onto Broadway to head east. If we ever needed to put a radius in order to be able to radius that curve more than it is today based on the curb line, we'd take the planter out to do it. And you'd still maintain a reasonable distance for the sidewalk within our public road right-of-way. So what our engineers have evaluated as it relates to this, and hence the reason that this particular plat has been delayed, was to go back out and, in fact, verify that the right-of-way that exists beyond what's being proposed to be platted here is actually sufficient in order to accommodate our standard sidewalk detail. The concern, the truncation would have allowed us the opportunity, obviously, to not have to worry about getting a temporary construction easement, but probably would have done nothing materially to the actual location of the sidewalk that's physically there today. So that's one reason why the analysis on this particular request took a lot longer to mature than some. I will tell you that the corner truncation requirements in the downtown have not been equally applied across the board over time. Some of that is, as Mr. Smith has pointed out, due to the fact that we have existing buildings that are already built to the property lines. And in other instances, our traffic engineering department has determined that there is no need to apply that particular standard because it is entirely impractical. We're not widening streets downtown. And you may already have sidewalks in place that are consistent with our sidewalk detail. Therefore, let's not make the issue out of it. Here we've got a surface parking lot. We have an unknown. We wanted the corner truncations as a part of the platting action. Because of that unknown, we went through further review and determined that we could achieve what we wanted to get with the truncations by getting the TCE, and that's why we're here. The other aspect is many of our lots in downtown are deemed legal lots. They'd never be replatting, and therefore you'd never have this particular issue come up. That's why this is a rarity. It was Mr. Reed's advice to his client and to the city to proceed forward with the plat for the purposes of being able to have two discrete lots that basically were not parts of previously platted lots under the original city subdivision. Some surveyors wouldn't be as diligent in trying to ensure that clean title is given, but that is the issue that's occurred here, and we're cleaning up title, we're getting better platting.
Any other questions?
I have.
Ms. Rushing.
If we don't approve the variance, would the current owner be required to make any changes to the property at this time?
No. There is no changes per se that would be required to the property. Currently, part of that is because the City of Columbia still owns the property at this time. So we, I'm sure we would probably be open to things that we would like us to do. But at some point in the future, that I think the intent here is for the west part of this property is, as Mr. Zinner had stated, to have two discrete lots for potentially selling off the city would retain the garage and the west property would potentially be sold or in some other manner released.
And then the second question, which may sound unusual, but the truncation, does it apply straight up or just to the first story?
It would, it essentially creates a new property line, and so no buildings above or no structure above ground level would be able to extend into and over that truncated area. It basically becomes, again, a public right-of-way, with the exception of potentially balconies, which I think may extend into right-of-way in some situations.
You'd end up having to, if you were to extend into a future public right-of-way, it would require a right-of-use permit at a particular height that's defined within the code. So you could, if you so desired to have developed a turreted building, for example, that basically mirrors the curves of the corner truncations and then put a Juliet balcony off of it, you'd have to get basically a right-of-use permit to encroach into the right-of-way.
But a developer could, let's say we don't approve the variance, and then the developer comes in, they could, for pedestrian traffic, have a curve on that bottom floor that wouldn't exist on upper floors. I mean, they would have to ask for a variance at that time.
If the variance wasn't approved,
then when it's developed and they still needed some relief, they would have to request a variance at that time, and
yes,
at which time we would get to see the project.
The property as it exists right now is actually, it would constitute, if I am correct, I believe it constitutes a legal lot right now. This platting action is to consolidate the lots. So
right.
To be quite honest, if the variance isn't approved, the transaction that is transferring the ownership of this property has already been approved. This is basically an action that is coming behind the documents to convey. And if the lot were not truncated, you could build a building out to the two corners. In the process of building that building, you would be required to install the standard city sidewalk. That would either be at a curved corner, or it would come out as it does today at a 90-degree intersection with the bulb bump out. And that is that's the essence of the situation here, is the current right-of-way that exists can accommodate a 90-degree sidewalk, and we basically have installed the bulb out in order to be able to reduce the pedestrian distance between the adjoining blocks out of public safety and convenience traffic calming. But the sidewalks then in and of themselves, if this were just a standard square block like any other city block, could basically be built and comply. Again, what's being requested here is a plat to clean up what has previously existed as multiple lots from the original city survey. There is, based on our traffic engineer's analysis of the street network, the future for improvements to either 5th, Cherry, or Locust, no need in order to get these truncations out of this lot. The only thing we need is the ability, should we as a city at some point come to build that sidewalk, get the TCEs if we need to get off. And that is that's completely a result of the grade differences between the streets adjacent and the elevation of the parking surface. We may need to get further on the property in order to be able to install the retaining wall, tie the retaining wall back in, and then basically build the sidewalk afterward. But no need for the truncation. The sidewalk will never curve. Sidewalks in downtown basically come to 90 degrees at our intersections. And given that there's no improvements desired here from the street network to widen the streets out any wider than they currently are, and we've got adequate right of way already, they can make everything work within it.
I guess my problem is that I don't see why we would grant the variance, because I don't see a need not to have the truncation. I understand what you're saying, that it's going to work without it. So every lot downtown where you can say that we can do a bump out and therefore it's going to work without the truncation, what happens to the truncation requirement?
And I think that was what was pointed out in the staff report, and I believe Ms. Lowe was trying to get at, that, and Mr. Smith was addressing. Our current corner truncation is a one-size-fits-all scenario for all property in the city. It does need to be considered to be revised with exceptions for downtown development. And that's just unfortunately the nature of how our code is constructed at this point. This was one of these that, as I've said in the past, we sometimes have to check our brain at the door for common sense. We looked at this initially. We said, no, we're replatting. We need to follow the rule. We started looking at it a little bit more, and we said, maybe we don't. But we have to follow through with the way the regs are, and that's exactly what you guys are debating, and you're having difficulty, I think, wrapping your mind around like we did. There is no real hardship here in the sense of a hardship, which is typically what you would approve a variance on. This is an impractical requirement given the circumstances. And because of that, the only option you have is to approve or not approve a variance. You can't ignore the standard because the standard exists. And if you look at it from the aspect of the evidence we're producing for you, that through analysis of the intersections, the right-of-way that we have, all of that mitigates having the need for that. That's the information. If you were a board of adjustment, for example, you'd be hearing this testimony and you would make your decision based on that, not just based on the hard facts of a 30-foot radius is required. There's other circumstances. I don't disagree with where you all, I think, are wrestling with this. You just don't see the need for it. We didn't either. However, we've also acknowledged that it's really not needed given the circumstances that are there.
Yes, Ms. Lowe.
Just point of clarification. Is this clarified in the UDO?
No.
No.
That's why we're begging. Just tell us to take care of it in the UDO, and we will. It's like the sidewalk issue. Mm-hmm. Ask us to take care of it, and we'll do what we can.
Yes, Mr. McMahon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a title issue with these TCEs afterwards, yes? We're going back and giving the buyer these, or we're having them give us.
They'll give us the
correct
TCE when we request it.
All right. The variance, the TCEs are in no way dependent upon the variance. Is that correct?
No, the way that we've worded it, the condition for staff's approval of the variance is that they agree to grant us the TCEs.
So they are linked?
Yeah.
They are,
yes,
linked. Is it possible for them to be unlinked?
Absolutely, if that's a motion that the commission would like to consider. But right now, staff's recommendation is that those are the two conditions involved with that.
If I may follow up on that. The TCEs make and the variance make this a more attractive property for the buyer? Is that correct?
I wouldn't think that the TCEs would necessarily have an impact.
The TCEs are for us.
Yes, yeah, for the city.
And the variance is for the buyer.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And they are currently linked in the title language. That's where we're at with this?
They would be linked in the ordinance approving, based on staff's recommendation, they would be linked in the ordinance that approves the variance.
I just want to, but the TCs and the variance don't have to go together.
No.
They're not
no
required in any way to be linked.
No, that's correct.
There is, however, Mr. McMahon, there is no reason, if you deny the variance, if you choose to deny the variance, there is very little reason at that point to potentially ask for TCEs. arrangement or the arrival at granting, at agreeing on a variance and obtaining the TCE upon request, that is the city. That's the city requesting that to protect our interests. Typically, we have to acquire TCEs for money. The platting process is one of these opportunities to where we either would obtain the regulatory standard, so you deny it. Commission decides to deny the variance request. This request is going to proceed forward to City Council with no corner truncations on it. Council approves the plat with no corner truncations, but does not include the TCE language as part of that approval. We say we have nothing. We go back and we buy the TCEs when we need it if we ever build a sidewalk. So when you ask if there's value to the property owner in not having the TCE or not having the corner truncation, yes, there is, because that is land area that is left in their control. But again, the TCE is to the favor of the city if we should go build the sidewalk. It's if we have to expend capital money to do it. If they redevelop this parking lot with a building, they will be building the sidewalks at their expense. And they have to then make accommodation for that in their building plan. So, you know, they're having the opportunity to have all of the land that they were contracted to be receiving without having the corner truncation. And therefore, that fulfills that side of the agreement that's already been acted upon. The TCE and the approval of the variance basically accommodates the city's needs for something in the future. And that's how this is how they're linked together. You unlink them, and it potentially puts the city in a position to where if we ever came to build those sidewalks before anything happened with this parking lot with the structure, we'd be buying them, or we'd be obtaining them. We'd re-release them back to the property owner when we're done with the construction project, which is the typical standard practice for a TCE. But we'd still have to pay for them up front.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Zinner.
Do you have any other questions? I have a quick one for Mr. Smith. Do we know what the intended use is?
For the west side?
Correct.
Nothing beyond what's currently there.
Okay. Okay.
Not that I'm aware of.
Thank you. No further questions. I'll open us up to a public here, to the public. If anyone would like to come forward and give us any information that would be relevant, this would be the time.
My name's Tim Reed. I'm a land surveyor with Engineering Surveys and Services. I don't really have much to add to the staff report. The corner truncation, it is a valuable design tool for new subdivisions, but the original town's been here since 1821, and the entire downtown area, it consists of rectangles, and traffic moves fine, pedestrian traffic moves fine. You can see at the northwest corner, that's the actual traffic island that's in place at actually all four corners of that intersection. And it's relatively new. It was a city initiated design, I think, for traffic calming and for pedestrian safety. There there just isn't any reason to give up a 30-foot radius at these two intersections, and we're happy with those conditions. We're fine with those conditions, so I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for the speaker? Thank you, Mr. Reed.
Thank you.
Are there any additional speakers to this topic? As I see none, we'll close the public hearing. Commissioners, comments, someone like to frame a motion? Don't be shy. Yes, Mr. Stanton.
The case of 16-101, 6 and Cherry Street, garage, sub. Let me back up.
Do I need to make two?
You want to handle this together or two different motions?
I would probably go ahead and approve the variance first. The variance would be necessary to approve the plat as shown basically in your packet, because if the variance is not approved, then the plat as displayed is not to current city standards with the truncation. So,
in case of 16-101, I move to approve the variance as recommended by staff.
We have a motion.
I'll second.
Mr. Toohey is second the motion. Ms. Secretary, may we have a roll call?
Yes. Mr. McMahon?
Yes.
Mr. Stanton?
Yes.
Mr. Strotman?
Yes.
Ms. Rushing?
No.
Mr. Toohey?
Yes.
I vote no. Mr. Harder?
Yes.
We have 5 votes for, 2 against. The motion carries.
So would any of the commissioners, is there any additional input on this item, or were there additional items that we would like to require as part of this condition?
Well, I would like to say if this is not a requirement that is necessary downtown, that perhaps we do need to take that into consideration with the new code. And my concern is it is the city of Columbia, and I do have a problem voting for the city not following its own requirements.
I would just like to add that we've been discussing a lot about how traffic might negotiate the intersection, and this, it's been studied and it seems to achieve that. But I think the truncated corners also deal a lot with sight lines and pedestrian movement around corners, and we haven't taken that into account. And I would agree with Ms. Rushing that we've essentially set a precedent now that says we're not going to truncate corners downtown, so we should codify that versus doing it on a case-by-case basis.
So we do we to, is there any motion on the conditions that were given to us by the city or by these by staff?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I took Mr. Stanton's motion as variance as recommended by staff, which would include the conditions.
Which would include so
if
those.
If that wasn't the intent, we can clarify that, but okay.
Yeah.
So his item was the temporary, the TCE, as well as the right-of-way.
Ready use permit.
So we're good with this matter.
Yes. You need to do the plat, though, now, if you would, please.
Yes.
The plat does need to be approved.
Mr. Stanton?
Case 16-101, I move to approve the final plat for 6th and Cherry Garage subdivision.
Is there a second?
I'll second again.
Mr. Toohey? Motion has been made and second. Can we have a roll call, Ms. Secretary?
So this is 16-101, approval of the final plat. Mr. McMahon?
Yes.
Mr. Stanton?
Yes.
Mr. Strotman?
Yes.
Ms. Rushing?
No.
Mr. Toohey?
Yes.
I vote yes. Mr. Harder?
Yes.
6 votes for, 1 against. The motion carries. Recommendation for approval will be forwarded to City Council.
Thank you, Ms. Lou. Moving on to the next item, case 16-105, a request by Crockett Engineering on behalf of Thomas Richards for a final two-lot final plat to be known as Russell Subdivision Plat Number 6. The subject site contains 2.94 acres and is addressed as 407 Russell Boulevard. May we have a staff report, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thanks. As you already said, I believe in the presentation here, it says 3 acres, but 2.94 acres. The site is located approximately 225 feet south of Sappington Street and also about a quarter mile south of West Broadway along Russell Boulevard. And it's just outside the aerial here, but Russell Boulevard Elementary is just off the page. That helps locate the site a little bit. So the lot, the proposal is to subdivide the lot with a new property line approximately 100 feet south of the existing north property line, which is to the right in this aerial photograph. And then basically follow that parallel to the towards the rear lot line until a point at which the new lot line takes a radial approach to towards the corner there. That allows access to the sewer for both lots. It's not an ideal situation, but given the circumstances, it's probably functional and makes sense that way. In as much as no new infrastructure will be required at that point, no performance contracts of any kind, and so on and so forth. The 100-foot width is significant in that it would disallow any further subdivision of the property, as our current code requires 60-foot lot width. So if it were 120 feet, it could potentially be divided again, but the 100 feet maintains kind of an estate lot feel for the neighborhood. This, all along Russell Boulevard, initially was the first Russell subdivision, was large 5-acre lots, basically squares on either side of the street. This existing lot is not perfectly maintained in that regard, but it's pretty close. It's one of the few remaining large lots along the street there. And as you can see, just to the north in this, the lots there have been subdivided further multiple times. But it was the intent of this owner to kind of maintain the large lot appeal on his lot. So I believe that is all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Are there any questions from the commissioners for staff? I have a question. The access for that lot would go on its own, and there would be no combined. It would have its own access to Russell Boulevard?
It hasn't been proposed yet, but that is the intention.
Thank you. I see no further questions. We'll open this to the public. If anybody in the audience would like to come up and speak on this matter, we would welcome that at this point. As I see none, we'll close this hearing. And commissioners, any comments, discussion, motion? Mr. Stanton.
As it relates to case 16-105, Russell Subdivision, plat number 6, I move to approve the final plat for Russell Subdivision.
Second.
A motion has been made by Mr. Stanton, second by Ms. Rushing. Ms. Secretary, may we have a roll call, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McMahon.
Yes.
Mr. Stanton.
Yes.
Mr. Strotman.
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Rushing.
Yes.
Mr. Toohey.
Yes.
I vote yes. Mr. Harder.
Yes.
We have 7 approving votes. Recommendation for approval will be forwarded to City Council.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe. Moving on to our last item, case 16-121, a request by THH Inc. McClure on behalf of Drury Development Corporation for approval of a one-lot final minor plat to be known as Drury Subdivision Plat 1. The 3.49-acre subject site is located at the southwest corner of Keene Street and I-70 Drive Southeast and addressed as 3100 I-70 Drive Southeast. Yes, Mr. McMahon.
Before we go on, I must recuse. So, ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful time.
May we have a staff report now?
Thank you, please. Mr. Chairman. As you stated, this is a one-lot final minor plat. It is for location there at southwest corner of Keene and I-70 Drive Southeast. Here is a view of that. It's the current location of the Howard Johnson Inn. In general, this request is to create a legal lot for future development on the site. They have dedicated the necessary right-of-way along Keene for a major collector, and all necessary easements are also dedicated via the plat. It does comply with all subdivision regulations, and we are recommending approval.
Nice and sweet.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Is there any questions for staff? As I see none, we'll open this to the public. If anybody in the group would like to come forward and give us any information on this matter, we welcome that. Just please give us your name and address.
Good Good evening. I'm Mark Cole. I live at 22 Limp Road in Kirkwood, Missouri. I'm with Drury Development Corporation, and I just wanted to quickly thank you for your consideration of the replat and also offer to answer any questions that you may have on the future redevelopment of this property.
Commissioners, are there any questions for Mr. Cole? I see none. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Anyone else would like to speak on this matter? We'll close the public hearing. Just go slow until Mr. Stanton gets back, but would any commissioners like any discussion on this matter? He's coming back. We kind of need him to come back.
I would point out as just a point of clarification that the northeast corner with the intersection of Keene and I-70 Drive southeast is the site of a potential roundabout in the future. And just as a note, the right-of-way being dedicated is adequate to enable to have that construction occur without any future right-of-way needed at that site. So that was something that we spoke with the applicant at the time of application in our traffic department to make sure that was facilitated. So it just happened to work out that it was generally coincident with the amount that they'd be required to dedicate. So,
and that was the northeast corner?
The northeast corner where the truncation is located, as shown.
Truncation.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Yes, Ms. Lowe.
I have a question about that northeast corner.
Sure.
What is a cotton picker spindle?
That's a great question. That is apparently a survey approved a locating tool that actually came from a cotton picking machine or gin or however you would describe it, and that was allowed to be used because they apparently wear out and they were plentiful, and so they were reused as markers for surveyors and they were stuck in the ground. Now, what they look like, I'm not sure I could tell you that.
When they tear up the intersection, Ms. Lowe, we will ask them to be gentle in that location.
I may have made a request to preserve one if one came across. So,
if you knew what it would look like.
That's the main problem. So.
And I think we have delayed enough for Mr. Stanton to return so we can vote.
It's in time for quorum. We were just making a couple of discussion points. Commissioners, any further discussion? Anybody like to make a motion on this matter?
Looks pretty straightforward. I'll move to approve case 16-121, request from THH Inc. McClure on behalf of Drury Development Corporation for approval of a one-lot final minor plat to be known as Drury Subdivision Plat 1.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe, for making that motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Mr. Toohey, thank you. Ms. Secretary, may we have a roll call, please?
Yes. Mr. Stanton?
Yes.
Mr. Strautman?
Yes.
Ms. Rushing?
Yes.
Mr. Toohey?
Yes.
I vote yes. Mr. Harder?
Yes.
We have 6 votes for. Motion carries. Recommendation for approval will be forwarded to City Council.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe. Any comments by the public? If there's anybody in the public that would like to give us a final comment, we'd welcome that. As I see none. Comments from staff? Mr. Zinner, we always know you're good for something over there, huh?
Well, you know, I haven't spoken enough tonight, so I'll speak up some more. Your next meeting is on June 23rd. We will again have our regular work session. We will then come and convene at 6 p.m. For discussion of the MDT zoning standards for that meeting. So be prepared. It should be an interesting meeting. But we have other items that will be carried on after 8 o'clock, and that is the Broadway and Hitt Street plat. This is the other one, as I was mentioning earlier, that we will have a variance and a variance as well as a right-of-way variance. Couldn't spit that out. We have also, as the subdivision side, then we will also have 2 public hearings, an annexation request up off of 763 American Truck Repair. This is just to the south of Prathersville Road. And then the Millard Family Funeral Chapels, and this is off of Ash, adjacent to their existing funeral chapel. They are looking at doing an expansion of the existing CP zoning to cover the vacant lot immediately to the west. For potential expansion of the funeral chapel itself. So Those are the items that are on the next agenda. And as we discussed in work session this evening, we will be providing a summary of tonight's comments as part of the continuous spreadsheet that we are utilizing to capture all of the questions or issues that have been raised with each of the sections we're going through. That will be provided to you as we produce our next agenda. And then the material that we have collected up to this point will be provided back out onto the city's website underneath the Development Code Update Project heading, and it will be the spreadsheet as it exists, as you saw this evening. So for public's purposes, they will hopefully have access to that and be able to see it, as well as, again, our meetings will be streaming live or accessible at any point by Monday of next week. You will have full access to that. You can replay anything that Mr. Teddy and I have said or any of our other staff to your heart's content. Here are your maps. Our Broadway and Hitt plat, as I had indicated, that is the Alpine Shop and a small building that is behind it that share a private alley. The American Truck Repair annexation request just south of Prathersville Road. And the Harvester is the industrial roadway, industrial park road that leads, that's in between Prathersville and Brown Station or International Drive. And then our request for the Miller Funeral Home in Chapels. This is actually an expansion of the existing CP plan. We're amending it to deal with some additional uses that were not included in the original CP plan, and then the vacant lot immediately to the west of that. And again, that is off of Ash, right behind or to the north of our water tower site there on Walnut. With that, that is all I have to offer for you this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Zinner. Anybody looking for a motion for adjournment? You may like to make that.
I do have a comment about, you know, with this issue with the parking task force and this being such a big part of the downtown part of this new development code, I mean, do we look at delaying some of this until we get the results back?
Look at maybe help coordinate with them on a timeline and maybe shortening theirs or making, you know,
it just seems like it's going to be a big part of what's required downtown in this code.
It sounds like there's going to need to be some coordination already just to achieve the tasks ahead. We're talking about adding meetings or extending the schedule. So I think this is something that's getting added to that hopper and will need to get shaken out.
I do think it's a valid point. And as we mentioned in our work session, the dates that we had are tentative. And as we discussed in our work session, those dates seem to be pretty challenging. And that's not even considering the parking task force portion of it. So I think it is a valid item to consider and figure out what their timeline looks like and see if we can blend those together so that if their intent was for UDO comment as it was, then yes, we need to get their input, in my opinion.
Do we need to change the schedule and move the downtown portion towards the very end of this to give them time to get a feel of what that task force is?
They're not
going to
commenting
do.
Only on downtown.
I believe the assignment is to deal with downtown only.
All right.
It is not the parking regulations apply citywide. We have specific provisions that are within the downtown. I think the scope of that exercise needs to be reviewed to determine, are they supposed to be making recommendations on parking utilization, space, standards for particular uses that are in the downtown and the MDT district only? The code as a whole and the parking standards that are within it apply citywide. To delay the adoption of the code, if all of the other pieces are correct and the focus of the parking task force is the downtown area only, would seem to be an unnecessary delay. An amendment to the parking standards, should the code move forward, is not something that would be uncommon. I mean, if we adopt a set of standards, that are based upon what we have completed, because the study of a task force has not been complete at the time that council would like to move the document forward, is no different than if we were to adopt a set of zoning standards and council asks us to go back and review a different piece of it at a different time. I mean, I think that that's the perspective that we may need to be looking at the project as a whole in. We are always going to have pieces that are incomplete. As I had noted this evening, our sidewalk provisions that are within the code are incomplete. They are not satisfactory in whole to us as a staff. However, they are what they are, and we will continue to work on them. And we may have to produce an amendment shortly after we adopt the code as a whole. That would be no different in the parking scenario, but I think we can bring back to you for the June 23rd meeting a better understanding of what that parking task force's actual objective was and how it may impact the overall code. If they are looking at parking standards that apply outside of downtown or potentially parking issues that may be affecting mall development or shopping centers or things of that nature, that may be something that we do need to consider. But again, parking is one of those things that is you have to have it. We have landscape provisions that deal with how you deal with the impacts. The number of parking spaces, if that is what we ultimately get down to, is maybe where the task force focuses. And I think the task force may, if it's focused on downtown, it's dealing with how do we deal with parking structures, meters, parking permit program. None of that is within the code's purview. The UDO doesn't deal with those types of issues. It deals with what's required, where, and how. It's not placing meters in front of it or having a permit program. So, I mean, I think that that's why I would suggest to the commission that we need to get some more information about what the true assignment was, figure out once we have that, what do we need to do. The MDT is much bigger than just parking, and I don't believe that it'd be appropriate to delay the June 23rd meeting to discuss the MDT to wait for the parking task force to complete its study of a very finite piece of that overall puzzle.
Yes, Mr. Stanton.
Well, my thing is hopefully we're not working all in our own bubbles. I would feel like they would understand the deadlines, especially if this was a task force from the city council, that they would be aware of our timeline. So if his intent was to advise us on the new code, I think there'd been better coordination, or maybe that wasn't the intent. So I don't know.
I think Mr. Zinner is correct in saying that I think some questions asked to council as to what the or even to the task force exactly what their job is, because you know they could be looking at marketing, how to promote employee parking versus customer parking, and there might be components that have nothing to do with our part of it. But at the same time, if they're looking at number of stalls and things of that nature that would have some impact on us, then that might be a point of discussion that we would want some time to coordinate with that task force, similar to maybe even the infrastructure task force that's getting ready to complete their report.
I mean, I think our issue is we just didn't see this coming when we started this process last month.
But somebody had to at city council. I mean, this has been an issue that's been on the table. Money's been spent. This has been on the table for quite a while. This task force is well aware of our task here, and that's what I'm saying. To slow our ship down, or I mean, I'm cool with coordinating and streamlining our calendar, but if that was the intent to advise us on parking, better coordination with a bigger deadline should have been done. Our ship's going to have to keep sailing.
I'd like to have city staff do some research on that exact definition as to what their duties are or their scope of work, and then advise us on our June 23rd. And then at that point, we would have a better idea if this was truly an impact to what we're reviewing, or if it's just a more of a marketing type items that maybe wouldn't impact our decisions. Everybody's okay with that?
That's
right. I think right now we're kind of going under some unclear certainty as to what their exact scope is, and I think it, the MDT is a much bigger issue than parking, and it's going to be a big component of it, but I don't think it's their only component.
If I may.
Mr. McMahon.
My sense is the MITF, the Infrastructure Task Force, they're going to go long. They're going to get extended. That's my sense, right? I mean, that's not written in stone, but anything that might apply to us, we want to keep that in mind also.
Thank you. Any other comments? If not, I would take a motion for adjournment.
Move to adjourn.
Mr. Stanton, do we have a second?
I'll second.
Ms. Lowe, thank you. We are adjourned. We are adjourned. Thank you.